Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Commerce Committee. Today is Cheers to Your Health Day. We're going to take up the liquor bill and a few other additional provisions that we will hear, lay over, and then offer as amendments to the omnibus liquor bill. And then we will have a couple of health bills that we will take up. And so, and then a bill from one of our own, Representative David. So we're still waiting on a quorum, I believe. And so we can get started with our agenda. It looks like Representative Anderson is here. Questions? Okay. We have a quorum now. Oh. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. And we have your House File 453 in front of us. That bill we have heard and laid over previously. We need to bring it back because it needs to make another committee stop, it sounds like.
Okay.
We have a quorum, and I will move your House File 453 be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation that it be referred to Agriculture Finance. And do you have an author's amendment, sir?
No, I do not.
You do not. Chair. Okay, just wanted to check. And so House File 453 is in front of us. Do you want to just give us a brief little sentence on why we're here and where we're going?
Well, I could talk longer. It's not storming today yet anyway, so we could discuss. No, it has to do with a liquor store, off-sale liquor store that makes its own ice. And because of a change in, I think, federal interpretation of food, the Department of Ag was using its total revenues for alcohol sales to determine the price it had to pay for a license to manufacture ice. And the license fee went from under $100 to nearly $800. And we're just trying to make it so they can exclude the value of the gross liquor sales when determining the cost of his license to sell ice.
Very good. Any questions from members? Seeing none. Anybody who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. I will renew my motion that House File 453 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation to refer it to Agriculture Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way. Nice
Thank
to
you.
See you again, sir.
I have one more. I'm going to wait with that
Are we
one?
Taking that other one?
Okay, very good. So we will next go to House File 2422, Representative Anderson. I have to get that one in front of me. 2422? Yeah, thank you. Okay, I will move that House File 2422. Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. To your bill, Representative Anderson.
And there's no amendment with this bill, Madam Chair, members. Again, simply has to do with a bowling alley back in one of my towns that they'd like to have an on-sale license to sell strong beer. Minnesota is only one of two states that now offers 3-2 beer. Us and Utah, I believe, are the two states. And some issues with getting a strong beer license having to do with having a restaurant on site, and I think we may have a testifier who would go over that, Madam Chair, and explain how this may work for these bowling centers that would like to get a strong beer license.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Carlson is here to testify on the bill. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and
thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Wine and Spirit Wholesalers, and I did have the opportunity to speak with the bowling center proprietor and Mr. In Representative Anderson's district today, and I learned a lot about rural bowling alleys, including that they're seasonal. He is looking down the road to make sure he can keep his bowling alley in operation, and applied to his city of Bruton to get a strong beer and wine license. And he was granted that license, but his kitchen falls a little bit short right now from what he would need to qualify on the state level for a full strong beer and wine license. I think working with AGED and with the proprietor, I think they can resolve their differences about the operational hours of the kitchen and its condition. So we have concerns about opening this up, and so we have concerns that way. But I think there is actually a solution for the bowling center to get what he needs, just in working through AGED, and I actually offered to help him walk through that process with the agency. So we don't support the bill as it's written, but not because we want the bowling alley to not have what they need. We think he can get it under the existing rules. So, and he was a very nice gentleman.
Thank you. And Mr. Carlson, if that that solution doesn't come to fruition, are there potential other legislative fixes that we could find to be comfortable? I know that this is this came to us last minute, and we're kind of working through the details, so would be interested to hear.
I think that conversation will probably need to take place. I should have mentioned he has both his current 3-2 beer license, but he also has a setup license, and we still have those kinds of facilities where you can bring your own booze with you and buy a soda from the proprietor. And so he has that license as well. And how we sort out that between a strong beer and wine license, those are all kind of larger questions that I think will at some point be discussed. But we just don't feel this solution, which I understand is come to Representative Anderson quickly, just isn't the right approach.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You did make me feel nostalgic for the days of beer and setups.
Yes.
When my folks would go out. Representative Anderson, hearing that testimony, I'll open it up to the committee, and we're doing this all. This is the way we work, folks, when we're working out the liquor bill. Hearing that testimony, would you prefer to try to work out the differences? And okay, very good.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think if we can work together and get this done, I'd like to go that way, not open it up more than it needs to be. So thank you.
I appreciate hearing that. Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, do you feel comfortable in keeping the legislation moving or pulling it? What's your preference at this point if the solution that Mr. Carlson is suggesting is not available? And I guess the second would be, is it available before the end of session? So we do need to go back and try to help your proprietor. We still have legislative time to be able to do it. If you could just speak to some of those issues.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, this is deadline week, isn't it?
And
if you could keep it alive and hopefully not have to use it, that would be preferable, but I understand the time constraints here, but that would be my first option, but I understand the situation, so it's up to the committee.
Representative O'Driscoll, follow-up, or, okay, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, I'm just trying to understand, I hear we have some opposition, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad bill. If we pass the bill as you are, what I don't understand is what are the negative consequences? We need to solve this for your proprietor. That's what we're trying to do, right?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreisha, yeah, I totally agree with you. But I understand that I just heard about this 2 days ago, and staff did a great job getting it together, getting a bill number at noon today.
Yeah.
And if we could keep it alive if we can't get things worked out, my first preference would be to keep the bill laid over and see what happens, Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. So follow up. So what's the motion? I'm sorry.
The motion is to lay the bill over.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, we have time. So, I would advocate we keep the motion going, we keep your bill going, give you some time to fix this.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Davis.
Pass.
All right. Very good. Any further discussion? Anybody else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Hearing what we're going to do. Okay. I will renew I guess House File 2422 is laid over at this time. Thank you for your willingness to work on the bill, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Very good. Next up.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lesch over here, I came in late and I saw I was first. Did you skip over me, or can we go, or how you feeling?
We're going to invite Representative Lilly down.
Oh, Lilly's here. Far be it for me to.
I tend to like to make sure that people who are just visiting can get in and get out, because we don't want them to know how much fun we have once they're gone.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
I think another way to phrase that for Representative Lesch is he will get last call.
Well played.
I'm here all evening.
It's not even Friday, and we've got our humor on full tilt. I like it.
What is Lilly trying to do?
I will move. Welcome, Representative Lilly. I will move House File 2433 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And to your bill, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the illustrious Commerce Committee. I used to love serving on this committee. It was. I think there's good reason it's in the basement. Former chairs weren't that funny except for Representative David. But the Atkins and Hoppy show, I wasn't so sure about. You could tell that to my friends. So thank you for hearing this. This is kind of a fun piece of legislation, and it's for the Twin Cities Marathon. A couple years past, through the effort of this committee, they were able to offer beer to the marathoners on Sunday. And so there's quite a few events that go on Saturday as well. So we're just hoping to add that on to the Saturday events. And to everyone that runs the marathon that's of age, drinking age, unless you're from the range. And that's essentially it. I have some testifiers here if you need them, or if you're in a quick fast track, whatever you want to do, Madam Chair, I totally am open to.
Representative Lilly, if it's okay with you, we'll see if members have questions on your bill. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as I look at the bill, it says on the grounds of the state capitol on both days of the weekend. And just so I can get some clarification from nonpartisan staff, the weekend is always defined as Saturday and Sunday, not Friday and Saturday or Friday and Sunday.
Mr. Kleinen.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I don't believe we have a strict definition of weekend in the liquor chapter, but I would imagine that it would have to be interpreted as Saturday and Sunday.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean. Further questions, Representative Creason?
Just very quickly, I see no problem with this, but any chance this will run us into trouble or run afoul of performance-enhancing drugs?
Maybe performance-declining.
Just checking. I've seen Representative Lilly run.
Representative Lilly, you may defend yourself.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. I've done this marathon a few times, and I was, as a non-drinker, I was very tempted along coming down the avenue there to partake. You get in front of the German House, and some others offer you some shots and maybe some things. So I was very tempted, but I would have probably taken an enhancing performance something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm just going to remind you, this is being recorded. You're on the record. just that note of caution there, friends. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want the committee to understand that I thought about running a marathon once, and then I thought about it.
Well, it's the thought that counts, right?
That's right. No.
So, any additional questions? It sounds like everyone understands the bill, and thank you. Final words, or are you ready to have me laid over?
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. It's nice to be back before this committee, but not all of us, Representative Davids, can be wrestling champions, so. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly, with that. And thank you to your testifiers for being here for possible questions. I will lay over, the chair lays over House File 2433.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Next up. Which one? This one. Sorry, I just got to, you're going to have to. Okay, Representative Lesch, I guess you were getting your moment in the sun here.
Okay, notwithstanding Representative Driscoll.
Your moment in the sun in the basement.
I'm sure someone's going to flash the light.
Representative Lesch, welcome to the committee. Do you have a testifier? Please come on down. Mr. Carlson. You can move your own bill.
I'll move my own bill, Madam Chair.
And
where am I moving it?
You are re-referring it to Ways and Means with a recommendation to Public Safety Finance.
Excellent. That'll be my motion, Madam Chair.
Very good. Representative Lesch moves House File 1909 to be referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation of Public Safety. Is there an amendment to your bill, Representative Lesch? I don't see one.
No, Madam Chair.
Excellent. To your
Thank
bill.
You. If I could have Mr. Carlson speak to it, that would please me to no end.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Carlson. You can reintroduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and on behalf of the Wine and Spirit Wholesaler Association and I believe everyone else in the industry, from MLBA, the MMUA, the labor, we all are in support of this bill. We appreciate you hearing this bill. It just puts some guardrails around the direct shipment of wine to consumers. It sets up a regulatory scheme that is in place in many other states. Happy to answer any questions. There was a question about the cost to DPS, and we're happy to sort that out in public safety, and we'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, do we know if this has to go to judicial and civil law and data, because I notice right at subdivision 36 after direct wine shipment, the first word is data.
Representative Lesch or Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, and Representative Dean, that is just a cross-reference to the existing statute. We don't think it needs to take a stop at Representative Lesch's committee, but we would be happy to go there. Well, happy might be too strong for yourself.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, I'm not recommending that it go there. I just was raising the question.
Additional questions, members? Seeing none, is there anybody else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 1909 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation of public safety.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and you're on your way, sir. Next up, Representative Carlson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess you sit on this committee. You are always welcome here.
Thank you.
But it's nice to see you at the testifiers table with your bill. Representative Carlson is going to carry the omnibus liquor bill this year, a prestigious honor. And we have House File 2290 in front of us, and we do have an author's amendment. So I'm going to move that House File 2290 be re-referred to the General Register. And, I don't have to move that. You're on the committee. Sir, please, move your bill.
Madam Chair, you're on a roll there. If you can continue on with where this is going, I'd appreciate it.
So House File 2290 is moved to be re-referred to the General Register. Would you like to move your DE amendment, sir?
Yes, Madam Chair, just procedurally, do you want us to speak directly to House File 2290 first or just go right into the DE one?
Representative Carlson, if we can get the shape in the bill, the bill in the shape that you would like, we can speak to the underlying bill and the bill as amended.
Very well, Madam Chair. then yes, I would like to move the DE1 amendment to get it into the author's preferred form.
Representative Carlson moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted to your bill as amended, Representative Carlson. And if you'd like to start with the underlying bill that was brought to us, that would be a great place to start. Since
okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the highly anticipated, not very exciting liquor bill. We've got several bills here, so I'll try to be brief in describing each. So the underlying bill, House File 2290, is the, I'm going to kind of flip through here a little bit. This is the Airport Commission extended hours. I have got Mitchell from the MAC. He's going to speak to that particular section at this time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Helferson, members of the committee, good afternoon. Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I think the bill is pretty self-explanatory. We are looking to get authority to set liquor sales hours, on-sale liquor sale hours inside of security at times that we wish. We actually have an exemption from the current law where we can open up at 6 o'clock for our restaurants that are behind security. But as we become more and more of an international hub and have more and more flights that are a little bit earlier in the morning, it continues to be a customer service issue. We look at all parts of the airport, from parking to throughput to bathrooms to concessions, and this is just one small piece of gaining the recognition that we do from our airport, and we have a lot of complaints about not being able to serve between that 5 and 6 in the morning. And instead of coming and asking for exemptions all the time, we just like to have the authority to set those times ourselves as we see fit. Just so you know, the typical times of serving for the airport are probably 6 until about 9 at night, not like a usual city that would be 8 or 9 or 10 in the morning until 2 in the morning. By 9 or 10 at night, we're pretty shut down and things are pretty quiet at that time. Maybe there's some special circumstances where we have some special flights that are later and stuff, that some restaurants stay open later, but we're actually more of a morning operation than we are after 9 and 10 o'clock at night, and so we just want to adjust to meet our passengers' needs.
Thank you, Mr. Killian. Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, and just a kind of quick question, does this affect like the duty-free shops or anything like that?
Interesting question. Mr. Killian.
Chair Helferson, only on sale, so none of the off-sale locations, it wouldn't change anything for that. Okay. This only affects on sale.
Thank you for the answer. Additional questions or discussion to this provision of the bill? Since this is the first time we're hearing this, is there anybody who would like to speak to this provision of the bill now?
Yeah.
Not seeing anyone. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Killian.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll continue on with the amendment.
Yes, and if perhaps it might be best, since members have heard all the other provisions that are in this bill at this point in time, we can do, we need to take care of two pieces of business. One, there is an additional amendment that we need to put on the bill of a bill that we have heard previously, and that is the A2 amendment. Mm-hmm. If you would like to move that amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Carlson moves the Anderson Carlson. Representative Carlson moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and that amendment is adopted. And if you would like to just run through the and remind us which provisions are in this bill.
Okay, Madam Chair, I believe this is Representative Lilly's bill, correct?
Just if you want to start with the bill as amended.
Yes.
And remind us what other provisions we added. We just added the Lilly provision, which is fresh on everybody's mind.
Okay, so now we're back to the amended bill. So starting with Section 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So Section 1 is Representative Hertas's bill, House File 1031. This is the temporary licenses restrictions. Allows more flexibility for a temporary license for municipalities under 10,000 people.
Thank you.
Section 2, Representative Juergens, House File 1462. And this bill is intoxicating liquor off sale, extending Sunday sales once every 7 years when Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve fall on a Sunday. That's what that bill does, or that section of the bill does. Turning to page 2, we have section 3, which is the one we just covered. This is the Airport Commission extended hours. Everybody's clear on that one?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually that's my bill, House File 2290. Section 4, this is Representative Murphy's House File 1815, continuation. What this does is addresses an accounting reclassification related to pensions. Some municipal liquor stores are included in that. Keep rolling. Section 5. All right, Section 5 is Representative Elkins, House File 1826, City of Edina, special license. You heard this bill a couple weeks ago, authorizing the Edina City Council to issue a special liquor license for Restoration Hardware, located at 6801 France Avenue South. And then last but not least, Section 6, we have Roseville Golf Course liquor license, Representative Becker Finn, House File 1119. If you will recall, this bill authorizes the Roseville City Council to issue an on-sale license to the Roseville Golf Course. And Madam Chair, I believe that completes my presentation.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Is there any Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to just make two clarifications, if I could. Representative Carlson did not discuss 2.1, which was the modification of Sunday sales from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. being modified to 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. That was also on the provision that dealt with the calendar shift of Christmas, New Year's. And then also just a further clarification on Section 4, the pension accrual. Under Gadsby 68 rule, it requires local units of government to accrue for pension benefits, even though those, when municipalities or local units of government pay their benefits and collect their matching contributions from employees, they are not a direct liability on the local municipal government. But the Gadsby rule requires them to account for those. So on the P&L statement, it may look like the company, enterprise fund of the local municipal does not actually make a profit because of the accrual. And I will use the term, quote unquote, phantom loss, because again, that's not something that's borne by the local unit of government, so long as they've complied with the state statute as it relates to retirement, collection, and transfer to the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative O'Driscoll, further discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, just looking at that Sunday, say I'm not obviously I didn't vote for Sunday sales, but just switching it from, you know, six, I mean, the morning part of it, I understand potentially for games or whatever, but, you know, moving it from five to, or from six to five, I mean, does that run into any, from, you know, some municipalities and cities and businesses that, you know, maybe from an hours of operation where they would, you know, a shift would potentially get done at a normal time at 5 o'clock if you're working on Sunday, where that would potentially impede some sales from five to six, you know, just from a thought, is there, you know, a reason why that would be a potential issue there, or where you might be limiting potential purchases because people are getting off work at 5 o'clock. Folks that are having to work on a weekend on a Sunday maybe don't have that.
It wasn't a concern that was raised. Does anybody else want to speak to that concern from the audience? I think that when the author of the bill, Representative Juergens, brought it to us, he was pretty clear when he brought his, bringing this forward for a local business in his district, and that was the request. And I think that there's some concern about, I also think that it's an attempt to make sure that the owner still gets to operate under the spirit of the law. So that's what I heard, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that that's what testimony was, and of course, we limited the number of hours of operation, so you had to do one with the other. And I think the argument could be made for, unfortunately, those individuals who may work 2-5 or past 5 on Sunday. Saturday is usually a good time to have to look at it.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, a lot of us made that argument. They could figure that out Saturday.
Well played. Okay, further discussion to this bill as amended. Seeing none, is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 2290 as amended? Seeing none. With that, Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 2290 as amended be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your work on this bill. Next up, Representative Cantrell. So this is why we're calling it Cheers to Health Day, because we started with cheers and we're moving to health. Representative Cantrell has House File 2009. I will move 2009 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. Is there any amendments? I don't see any. Oh, there is an A1 author's amendment. I will move the A1 author's amendment to your bill, Representative Cantrell. Is there an amendment to your bill? Nobody can find it. Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if the amendment made it here. It appears that it wasn't in the materials, so...
Representative Cantrell, in that case, and we don't have rules in this committee, but it does have another committee stop. Yeah. Is that an amendment that can be taken up in your next committee stop?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay, are members comfortable with that? What is it?
It just makes a couple technical, or Madam Chair.
Excellent point, Representative Davis. Representative Cantrell.
Just makes a couple technical changes to okay. The bill, not substantive.
So they'll hear it in HHS policy?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Destination Farmington Medical Center.
Okay, so we have House File 2009 in front of us to your bill, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It is a pleasure to join you so soon again. So House File 2009 is a really important bill. It prohibits the use of step therapy protocols or the requirement of step therapy protocols for individuals who are suffering from stage 4 metastatic cancer. There was a session law that was passed last year, Chapter, I believe, 168, that basically outlines the protocol for requesting step therapy override. For folks who are going through stage 4 metastatic cancer, they usually don't have the luxury of time or resources to navigate through that step therapy protocol override. So what this bill does is ensures that if someone's at that point in their treatment, that they're able to get the drugs that they need. And this, of course, is a bill that's particularly important to me as someone who suffered from stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2017. I saw a lot of folks who just weren't able to get the medications they need. This bill does have precedence. It was authored by former Representative Kelly Fenton a few years ago, and included in your packets, you should find a letter of support from the Susan G. Komen Foundation for the Cure. Madam Chair, with that, I'll yield.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Is there anybody who wishes to testify for or against this bill? I seeing no one. I saw people moving, so I wanted to be sure. We can move to member questions. Representatives. Oh, okay.
I saw him raising his hand. I didn't know.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Kind of, you know, as this treatment kind of lines go, you know, you have the step therapy where folks, do you have a percentage breakout where folks are finding cures along that way, so you've got that first step, second step, third step on a cost basis? Like, have you tracked any of that, like, from a data standpoint?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swedzinski. I have not examined that data. However, this bill, I believe, addresses the concern of access for folks who are dealing with a very serious and life-threatening stage of their metastatic cancer.
Representative Swazinski.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think that's, you know, from a data standpoint, it would be interesting just to know, you know, from a reality standpoint of what folks are facing, from a steps, what's current going on, you know, if folks are finding relief, you know, earlier in the, from a stage step to later. It's just
Thank you.
I'm going to stop talking now.
That's fine. Other discussion? Representative Elkins.
Yeah. I just, I'm a cancer survivor myself, and I know that the treatments are evolving rapidly, but it, from the research I did, and I had melanoma, not breast cancer, but at any given time in my research, it was usually the case that there was a standard of care based on the most effective drug available at that time, based on a particular stage and genomics as well, depending on what gene mutations the person might have, especially with breast cancer. And so I'm having trouble imagining where, given the state of the art right now, step treatment would be appropriate in cases like this. So I support your bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Further discussion, members? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2009 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Representative Schultz. Welcome to the committee, Representative Schultz. I will move that your House File 533 be re-referred to Health and Human Services Policy. And I see there is an A1 Author's Amendment. Is that your amendment?
I think it's an A7. Or
it's an A7?
Maybe. Is it an A1?
Okay. Sorry. I jumped the gun. The Author's Amendment is the A7. Very good. I will move the A7 Amendment. The A7 Author's Amendment. Is there discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the shape the author wishes. To your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 533 addresses an issue. In 2017, legislation was passed to allow for-profit health insurance companies to sell plans and products in Minnesota, with really very little accountability or oversight if a nonprofit wanted to convert to a for-profit. And so this bill provides oversight and rules and regulation for those possible conversions. And I'm going to have an expert attorney here with me explain the language in this amendment, which is a significant change to the underlying bill.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Velzen. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I also manage the office's charities division. So give you some background here momentarily on why this bill is so important. I'm, of course, here testifying on behalf of the Attorney General's Office. Attorney General Keith Ellison is committed to protecting the public's interest and supports this bill as a way to better protect Minnesota taxpayers when charitable assets being held for their benefit are transferred from health maintenance organizations or HMOs to for-profit companies. So a little bit of background. From 1973 until the law changed in January 2017, HMOs in Minnesota have always been nonprofits. They have received substantial benefits as a result of their nonprofit status for these four decades where they were nonprofits. These benefits include, of course, various tax exemptions, and also the nonprofit HMOs have generated significant revenue as a result of managing the state's managed care contracts. From 2002 to 2012, HMOs received about $21 billion in Minnesota taxpayer money as revenue for managing those contracts, and those contracts were worth $5 billion in 2015 alone. Minnesota's major nonprofit HMOs collectively hold about $6.4 billion in charitable assets, $2 billion of which are reserves, and that's at the end of 2017. Given all this beneficial treatment by Minnesota taxpayers. HMOs have necessarily reaffirmed that their purpose is to serve public, not private interests, mainly to promote public health in Minnesota. This brings us to conversions, as Representative Schultz referenced. A conversion is basically the switch of the status of a nonprofit to a for-profit. It can take several forms, but by far the most common way to convert is a simple asset transfer from the nonprofit HMO to a new for-profit HMO. The question then is, when this occurs and there's a transfer of assets, what happens to the billions in charitable assets that those HMOs have been holding for the benefit of the Minnesota taxpayer? Do they go back to Minnesotans who have subsidized their operations for four decades, or do they go to the bottom line of the new for-profit company? We believe that HMO's charitable assets should be protected and preserved for the benefit of Minnesotans. Unfortunately, this doesn't always happen, and the reason we know this is because of conversion issues that have arisen in other states relating to golden parachutes being granted to HMO executives, the shortchanging of taxpayers in those states. I'll give you a few very quick examples. In Ohio, the management of the nonprofit Blue Cross of Ohio accepted an offer to sell the nonprofit health plan to a for-profit company. The sale did not provide that the Ohio public would receive any benefits from this conversion. But instead, various Blue Cross executives in Ohio were scheduled to receive $25 million in payouts as a result of the sale of these charitable assets. Something similar happened in Indiana. Preceding the public stock offering of the nonprofit Blue Cross of Indiana, its executives purchased 985,000 shares of stock in the successor for-profit. The executives paid about $261,000 for these shares. Soon after the initial stock offering, the value of the HMO executive's stock holdings went up by 10,000% to more than $29 million. Again, something similar happened in Georgia, where the nonprofit Blue Cross of Georgia converted to a for-profit corporation, and the Georgia public received nothing in return. Shortly after converting, Blue Cross of Georgia sold itself to a for-profit insurer, and the company's executives and employees received $28 million in bonuses. Now, these are not isolated incidents. Issues with conversions and golden parachutes and shortchanging of the public have happened in at least 15 other states, and that's just based on some preliminary research I did. Now, this contrasts sharply to what can occur if there's a proper regulatory bill in place. This has happened in California as one example. There, when a conversion was proposed, instead of the issues arising that arose in Ohio, Indiana, Georgia, instead, because California had a proper conversion law in place, $3 billion in charitable assets were set aside in a new nonprofit foundation that continues to exist for the benefit of the California public. That's the type of result we want in Minnesota if there's ever a conversion here. So this brings us to House File 533. House Research has a packet that explains what each provision in the bill does, and I'm happy to answer any questions at any point in time, so I'll just give a very broad overview of the bill. So the bill does essentially two things. First, it subjects large nonprofit to for-profit asset transfers to Attorney General review to ensure that the asset transfer is in the public interest and that Minnesota charitable assets are protected and preserved for the benefit of Minnesota taxpayers. The second main thing it does is subjects asset transfers out of state. So if a Minnesota HMO tried to transfer Minnesota nonprofit assets to another state, it also subjects that transaction to prior AG review. And again, that's attempting to keep Minnesota nonprofit assets in Minnesota for the benefit of Minnesota taxpayers. Now, this only is subjected to large transactions. The threshold triggering the review is basically $10 million or 10% of the HMO's assets. So it's only very large transactions to which the bill applies. One quick point I also want to make is the bill is not retroactive. It would not apply to any conduct that has already occurred. It would only apply to conduct that occurs after its effective date of July 1, 2019. That being said, I'm happy to answer any questions on particular sections or subdivisions of the bill if members have them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? And we will just keep public testimony brief to 2 minutes. So, oh, my apologies. There is a list. So I see Ethan Vogel will be first.
Madam Chair, before we take
testimony. Rick Varco is on deck.
Madam Chair, before we take testimony, may I ask a quick question?
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. The research summary we had online last night and the one we were passed out today is written for the A1 amendment, and we passed the A7 amendment. Can we have nonpartisan research for the author? Just are there substantive changes between those two amendments?
Chair and Representative Garofalo, I'm going to ask analyst Elizabeth Clarkvist to come up, as she is the one who has drafted these lovely amendments.
Welcome, Ms. Clarkvist.
And Madam Chair, Ms. and the, if they're not substantive, just say they're not substantive. You don't have to run through it if it's like the and the and stuff like that. So.
Thanks for that clarification. Ms. Clarkvist.
Madam Chair and members, there are, I would say, some substantive changes, and I can try to point them out. I will apologize in advance if I miss any. Let's see. The first addition was on page 2, a definition of full and fair value was added. There's a requirement that that an entity transfer the full and fair value of their assets. And so this defines the term full and fair value.
For members' information, we are getting new summaries delivered to us right now. So, but the walkthrough will be helpful.
The next changes, I think, are on page 6. Language was added. Language was added related to conversion benefit entity requirements. The conversion benefit entity is required to operate to benefit the health of the people in the state, so that's 6.16. And paragraphs D and E, which start on line 7.4, were also added, related to Attorney General approval of the governance structure and establishment of a community advisory committee. Also on page 7, Subdivision 5 was rewritten to require one or more public hearings to be held, and also to require the Attorney General to develop and maintain a summary of the materials that were collected in the public hearings, and to obtain answers to questions asked, and to maintain and make available those materials to members of the public. The final change is something that's no longer in the amendment. There's no longer any data classification language in the amendment, and that was Subdivision 12, but it was removed.
Just one question.
Madam Chair, was there...
go ahead, Representative Graffa.
Thank you. Yeah, see, I don't get to talk unless you say it's okay. I don't... Yeah,
the way it works.
No, not forever.
If only that were true. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Garofalo.
So was there a reason why this research summary wasn't distributed?
Representative Garofalo, this bill was calendared for a different day, and so the research summary was for the previous amendment that was on the bill, and since that they put the rest of the amendment together in one.
Gotcha.
So okay. We went from 3 to 1.
Super. Thanks.
Thank you. So that was the old research summary. Sorry about the confusion.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Clarkvist.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I just remembered one additional change.
Ms. Clarkvist. Thank you.
I apologize. Madam Chair and members, I'd also like to point out that on page 11, a definition of material amount was added on 11.10 to 11.12.
Okay. Thank you for that addition. Is there, we have our testifier, Mr. Vogel. Welcome to the committee.
All right.
You can state your name for the record and proceed.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. I want to start by thanking Representative Schultz for your time and dedication on this important issue. AFSCME is a public and private sector labor union. We represent over 43,000 workers in Minnesota. AFSCME members help make Minnesota happen. Among many other things, they work in our state's correctional institutions, they plow our roads, they stock our lakes with fish, and they help keep our kids safe from abuse and neglect. Our mission at AFSCME is to advocate for excellence in services for the public, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all workers. So excellent services for the public. In the short term, of course, this means we must invest in those services. Excellent services over the long term means we must be dedicated to responsible budgeting practices and policies which strengthen public trust in government. I'm here to express our support for House File 533 because this bill will help strengthen public trust as we continue to invest public dollars in public health programs which ultimately benefit nonprofit tax-exempt HMOs. It'll help build trust as we make other investments which also benefit these organizations, such as direct premium subsidies and state-based tax credits. Let's face it, trust for our healthcare system, and more specifically our health insurance industry, is at an all-time low. And considering Minnesota is on the verge of allowing nonprofit tax-exempt health plans to transfer public assets to for-profit private companies, we need to do something. If you don't adopt the provisions in this bill, whatever trust remains will be ground to absolute dust. Oversight from the Attorney General's office, an independent expert to assess the value of assets, a public notice and public comment period. I mean, these are all things the public expects us to do, and if we don't do them, we will completely undermine trust in future public health investments. So please support House File 533. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Next up, Philip Cryan, followed by Laura Sales. Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Philip Cryan. I'm with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We're a union of more than 35,000 healthcare workers all across the state in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and in-home care. And I have the honor of having been elected by the union's members to serve as executive vice president. And on our membership's behalf, I'm here today to testify in support of House File 533. For many years, one of the distinctive characteristics of the healthcare landscape here in Minnesota was that for all the many flaws and problems with health insurance policies and options available to consumers, only nonprofit entities could offer health plans here. When the legislature debated and ultimately voted a couple years ago to allow for-profit businesses to enter the state's health insurance market, the members of our union, who are frontline caregivers all across the spectrum of healthcare services, strongly opposed that change. But as concerned as we were about the decision to allow for-profit businesses, entities that are legally obligated to maximize shareholder value without accountability to the public and lawmakers that comes with nonprofit status to begin providing health insurance in our state, we were far more dismayed once that policy change was adopted by the legislature to find that the lawmakers who pushed for it did not have a plan for protecting hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer-supported assets held by the state's nonprofit health plans. When former Attorney General Swanson confronted lawmakers with the ethical and legal dimensions of this abdication of responsibility to taxpayers and the public, the legislature punted. Rather than seriously evaluating policy options to protect Minnesota taxpayers from the very real dangers posed by unregulated conversions, they simply bought some time and sent the responsibility to all of you, the next legislature. So here we are. It is up to you now to make sure that we put laws in place that protect hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer-subsidized assets from being captured by newly for-profit businesses created out of former nonprofits. The bill...
we hit your 2 minutes, so if you can just give us your closing sentence.
I'm sure everyone on this committee is very familiar with, despite all the strengths in our healthcare system, the racial disparities disparities in inequity that are a central challenge that our healthcare system faces. This bill, for all of the reasons that we wish that we were not having this debate.
That's a little longer than a closing sentence on a new topic. So we're going to ask you to stay on deck in case people have questions, and we can move to Ms. Sales. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Representative Halverson and members. My name is Laura Sales, and I'm a lobbyist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We're a labor union of about 22,000 members that live and work all over Minnesota and in parts of Iowa, Wisconsin, and now North Dakota. We are a leader in both the labor and healthcare communities and a voice for our members on issues related to the professional, economic, and general well-being of nurses and in promoting the health and well-being of the public. We are here to testify in support of House File 533 as amended, a bill that would add attorney general oversight to conversions by healthcare corporations. It would also help ensure that net earnings of such companies continue to be used for nonprofit purposes. Currently, HMOs hold billions in assets that were built with the tax benefits of being a nonprofit organization whose mission is to serve the public. That money is gained in part by the tax advantages that nonprofits receive. Those assets were also built with public dollars by serving people on public health programs. As advocates for patients and public health, nurses ask, what will happen to the billions of taxpayer dollars that HMOs currently hold if they convert to for-profit entities? House File 533, as amended, can help answer this question. It will assure that the fair value of a nonprofit's assets at the time of the conversion are captured, which will prevent any undervaluation. It will also create charitable trusts that will make sure that any charitable assets, which were built with public dollars, will still be used in the interest of the community these companies serve, and will be administered with a transparent, fair, and open process. Lastly, and most importantly, the bill will make sure that there is public awareness of and input into these decisions. So bottom line, we urge you to support House File 533 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sales. Next up, Sarah Greenfield, followed by Catherine Kmit. Welcome to the committee. Amy's keeping time, so I forgot to mention, watch Amy.
Okay.
And you can state your name and proceed.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I represent Take Action Minnesota, and we're testifying in support of House File 533. Take Action opposed the decision to allow for-profit HMOs to operate in our state. However, if for-profits are permitted, we should learn from the experience of other states, many of whom didn't pass conversion regulations until egregious conversions had already transpired. In California, the strong conversion regulations mentioned earlier were inspired by a series of conversions in which nonprofit public benefit assets were undervalued, and I can pass out a chart describing some of those, if someone's willing. Blue Cross of California later transferred most of its assets to for-profit WellPoint, retaining 10% in a nonprofit shell, and they insisted they had only restructured. They offered to distribute $100 million of their assets to a charitable foundation, and it was only under the strength of the regulations that had since passed that they eventually agreed to distribute all of their assets, that $3 billion that was mentioned, to two foundations. In 2002, WellPoint offered to buy CareFirst of Delaware, Maryland, and D.C. for $1.3 billion. Because of conversion language they had just passed, the insurance commissioner was able to review the purchase, hold public hearings around the state, uncovering, among other things, that $75 million was to go to CareFirst executives. That conversion was found not to be in the public interest and was denied. Those big Ohio payouts to CEOs were described in the Wall Street Journal as a thinly disguised kickback for selling out at a lowball price. They led to all right conversion language and eventually $28 million in charitable assets, but that was still less than the full value, and they were directed to a foundation under direct influence from the insurance company. So a lot is at stake in getting this right. These examples point to the importance of three things, which this bill does well. The Attorney General has the opportunity to review conversions, gather independent assessment of value, and protect public assets. The public has the opportunity to have input in those decisions, and equally important, the governance of the resulting conversion benefit entity is independent and responsive to community needs. We ask you to support House File 533.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Kmit. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Kmit. I'm here from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which represents Minnesota's seven nonprofit health plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. First, I want to say my colleagues and I appreciated the opportunity to meet recently with staff from the AG's office to better understand the problem that they want to solve. I also understand that the public wants to know that health insurance premiums they pay will be used for health care in Minnesota. We hear that message loud and clear. Please recall that back in January 2017, the language that was included in the premium subsidy bill to remove the requirement that all HMOs must be nonprofit was language that we did not ask for to be put into the bill. However, it was enacted, and it's now in place. That was 2 years ago. Today, the health insurance landscape has changed as for-profit HMOs are entering the Minnesota market. Let me be clear. Minnesota's nonprofit health plans are not afraid of more competition, but we are very concerned that some of the changes proposed in this amendment will create unintended consequences by giving a clear advantage to for-profit HMOs over the local nonprofit HMOs. As a result, we respectfully oppose this amendment. As we read it, this amendment attempts to deal with two issues. The first issue relates to nonprofit HMOs attempting to convert to for-profit, and the second issue relates to restrictions regarding asset transfers. With respect to conversions, the language in this bill imposes very broad and sweeping regulatory authority by the AG to review and evaluate any effort to convert. Minnesota's nonprofit health plans are not interested in converting to become for-profit entities. It is not who they are, and it is not who they want to be, period. 2 years ago, after the premium subsidy bill was enacted and the language to require nonprofit HMOs was repealed, there were concerns about the possibility that some nonprofit HMOs might try to convert to for-profit. As Mr. Belzin said, there was discussion about several instances 20 to 30 years ago in other states where conversions of nonprofit health plans to for-profit health plans were handled badly. Madam Chair, if I could just impose my and respectfully request that I could have just a tiny bit more time. Thank you.
The author approves.
I appreciate
yes,
that.
Please, go ahead.
To address these concerns, the legislature instituted a moratorium on conversions for 2 years. That moratorium expires on July 1st of 2019. Clearly, in the last 2 years, there have been no efforts to convert. Rather than impose all of these new requirements, it seems easier to simply extend the moratorium. Again, the council members do not wish to convert to for-profit HMOs. We also have significant concerns about the language regarding asset transfers. First, the language beginning on line 11.6 prohibits a nonprofit HMO or a direct or indirect parent, subsidiary, or other affiliate of such an entity from being able to transfer more than the material amount or $10 million. We are very concerned that an outcome of this language would be that the current nonprofit HMOs would not be able to exist because the affiliates with which they are connected may not be able to function. The for-profits will have no such restriction, and they will rush in to take advantage of this fact. Language on line 3.3 of the A6 amendment is also very A7 amendment is also very limiting. The provision defines material amount as the lesser of 10% of a nonprofit healthcare entity's total net admitted assets, or $10 million. This definition severely limits a nonprofit HMO from being able to move assets within the organization for the purposes of Minnesotans to be able to better serve members. This restriction does not apply to the for-profit HMOs, however. They would not be subject to the same restrictions. This is a decided advantage for the for-profit HMOs. Furthermore, the bill creates a new oversight process by the AG on any type of asset transfer over $10 million. This represents a very small percentage of the net assets of several Minnesota nonprofit HMOs. So, whether intended or not, the question is, will the changes proposed here ultimately create a much more advantageous market for the for-profit HMOs? If the rules are more flexible for the for-profit HMOs, they will attract more for-profits to the state. Again, we do not oppose the extension of the existing moratorium on nonprofit HMOs converting to nonprofits. The proposed changes requiring some kind of notice and review is a different issue. The effect of this language will encourage the expansion of for-profit HMOs while restricting the ability of nonprofits to compete. That seems counter to the goals of the proponents of this legislation. I'm almost finished. This committee faces an important decision. What is the best public policy direction the state should take when it comes to HMOs? I urge the committee to carefully consider the implications of this language. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to meet with the staff from the AG's office to better understand the problem they want to solve, and we look forward to continued discussion. The language addressing conversions to for-profits and asset transfers needs more work. For all of the above reasons, we respectfully oppose this amendment, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Is there anybody else from the audience who wishes to speak for or against this bill, or we can move to member discussion? We, seeing none, we will move to member discussion, and all the hands are up. I will start with Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could Ms. Greenfield return to the testifying table, please? Ms. Greenfield?
Ms. Greenfield. And Representative Dean.
Madam Chair.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Greenfield, something that you had shared in your testimony kind of caught my ear and was resonating with me. And it gave me pause to want to ask you a little bit more about the nature of that. And it was towards the end of your testimony, you indicated that the Wall Street Journal reported or suggested that these bonuses that CEOs received were as a result of a lowball sale price. Could you just reread that section one more time? I just want to make sure I caught that correctly.
Yeah, Ms. So Greenfield, if you can reintroduce yourself for the committee and then proceed.
Yes, Sarah Greenfield with Take Action Minnesota, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. It was to say that there were large payouts in Ohio to CEOs, and I don't think I mentioned, but they had sold a nonprofit for, I say, $300 million, I believe, but I could get that for you exactly. They then were offered some significant payouts, and those were described in the Wall Street Journal as a thinly disguised kickback for selling out at a lowball price.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, and that's what I want to pursue with you. It said it was described in the Wall Street Journal. Was that an op-ed piece by the Wall Street Journal? Was that a news article by the Wall Street Journal? Was that an opinion piece that appeared in the Wall Street Journal? Just wanting to know if a little bit more about what that source would have been. Or, I mean, obviously it appeared, but I just want to know the source of the author on that.
Ms. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's a fair question. I do not recall off the top of my head, and I would be happy to get that for you.
So, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So it is fair to say that although it was reported, it's not necessarily a news-based article. It might be an opinion-based article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, someone's opinion as to the terms surrounding the potential sale. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, to the author, I support the value of ensuring that nonprofit assets are used for the public good. That's kind of a description of when you have a nonprofit. But I have many concerns with this bill and feel that it's just an overreach of something that you're trying to solve. So a couple of questions in that regard. Can you state if any plan in Minnesota has indicated that they want to become a for-profit company?
Representative Schultz, or if you want the Attorney General's office to join you, that's fine too.
I would love to have the Attorney General's office join me. Have they stated to me personally that they have plans to convert? No.
Not you personally, but any indication. Have we had any indication in the past 2 years that would be the case?
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, I'll let the AG's office answer that.
Please proceed. You can reintroduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Ben Belzen from the Minnesota Attorney General's office. Madam Chair, to the representative's question, the last 2 years the moratorium has been in place, so they could not have converted.
Representative Haley.
Yeah, that's not quite what I was asking. Any other indication in the marketplace that that's where would be their intention down the road?
Madam Chair, Representative, similar to Representative Schultz, I have not had HMO personally tell me they intend to convert. What I can tell you is that in the past, HMOs have filed court documents in proceedings with this office and have personally told me that they believe some of the laws meant to protect charitable assets in Minnesota do not apply to them.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. Can you address, I think, what are some possible unintended consequences as well of the legislation? And would for-profit HMOs, and we do have some that have entered the market, would they be subject to these same rules that you're proposing in this bill?
Mr. Velznik.
Madam Chair, Representative, This bill, the intention of this bill is to protect the billions in nonprofit assets, the charitable assets that HMOs have accumulated after the over the prior four decades. Furthermore, many sections of this bill will only apply to nonprofit HMOs if they seek to transfer their charitable assets to a for-profit company or if they seek to transfer assets out of state. As I mentioned before, too, nonprofit HMOs receive various tax breaks and things of that nature that I think, including being able to administer the state-managed care contracts as well. So this bill was only intended to apply to nonprofits, not to for-profit companies for those reasons.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The level that you're setting for these conversions is $10 million.
Correct.
Can you give us an indication of the size of the HMOs in Minnesota? And I believe at $10 million, it could be approximately 1% of, say, a billion-dollar company.
Mr. Belzen.
Madam Chair, Representative, the respective HMOs, nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota, vary in size. I don't know the exact gross assets of each HMO. I think Blue Cross is the biggest. I think Health Partners is the second biggest. I think Medica is the third, and I think UCARE is the fourth. Now, if I forget UCARE's assets. I looked it up in preparing for this testimony. I don't have it off the top of my head. I'd be happy to get that to you. But I believe that $10 million would be more than 1% of UCARE's assets. For example, I think there's even some smaller HMOs in Minnesota, too. But, again, I don't have that information right at my fingertips.
Representative Haley.
Well, let's say a billion-dollar company. Let's just take a billion, which is not an unreasonable for a healthcare organization. 10% or 10 million then is 1%. Is that really feasible to execute? And again, I'm getting it. I think this is a would create then an unfair advantage for a for-profit company because of the stipulations that this bill would require a nonprofit to take on anything, any conversion of less than 1% of their assets.
Mr. Velzen.
Madam Chair, Representative. The $10 million threshold found in Section 4 of the bill, the main regulatory section of the bill, only applies to asset transfers when that nonprofit is handing over their charitable assets to a for-profit, which, in our opinion, they shouldn't be able to just give charitable assets to a for-profit company.
And, again, we've had no indication they're doing that.
Haley.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
What's that?
Mr. Velzen.
I'm sorry, I missed the representative's question.
You can continue.
Representative Haley.
He can continue.
Okay. Mr. Velzen.
Madam Chair, Representative, so that $10 million threshold is only triggered if the nonprofit HMO is handing over its assets to a for-profit or if that nonprofit HMO is trying to transfer those Minnesota assets out of state. Section 4 of the bill, which we're talking about, does not apply outside those two narrow contexts.
One last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. The waiting period in this bill is 150 days, I believe, correct? Why is that so much longer than other nonprofit waiting periods, which I believe are a third of that, maybe 40 days?
Mr. Velzen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe you're referring to Statute 317A.811. The waiting period there is 45 days, and the reason the waiting period here is so much different is these are hugely complex, multi-billion-dollar transactions where you have to value assets, you have to assess the value of the asset, you're going to have to get experts, independent experts, to assess the value of the assets and then make sure that those the transaction and the assets and their valuation and how the transaction is structured in this very large merger is in the Minnesota taxpayers' public interest. And in those contexts, like that used to be an antitrust, it's almost like a merger and antitrust, the waiting period, it's a complex analysis, and so the waiting period needs to be a little longer. So
Representative Haley.
Thank you. Just a final comment. And to your point on how complex these are, again, none intended consequences. I'm concerned about the cost of health care. And I'm concerned that you're going to wrap up our nonprofit health care organizations in months and months of paperwork and process for potentially 1% of their assets on any conversion when we could simply extend the existing moratorium. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the speaker from Take Action Minnesota, Ms. Greenfield.
Ms. Greenfield.
And then after that, I have a second question for the author.
Welcome back, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Grinfield, in your testimony, you criticized the large payouts to healthcare executives. I believe it was in Ohio. And I was surprised to hear Take Action Minnesota take a stance like that, because when we had large payouts to MNsure executives in Minnesota, I don't remember Take Action Minnesota taking a public position on that. So why?
Representative Garofalo, is this line of questioning in order? Or, we're not talking about MNsure. We're talking about.
Well, I'm trying, Madam Chair. I'm trying to lay a foundation here for why one type of executive compensation is acceptable to public policymakers, but another type is unacceptable. Because ultimately, it is public money either way. That was the statement that we were given. So I'm trying to figure out why the discrepancy in public policy. Because perhaps we could put some accountability measures on this bill for. MNsure executive compensation as well.
Representative Garofalo, I would say that we should stick to the questions with regard to this bill and this piece of legislation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Then I'll ask my second question of the author.
Very good, yes.
Representative Schultz, my network of spies at the Capitol keeps me very well informed. Are you aware of any intentions to attach House File 533 to the reinsurance bill?
It's a great idea.
Representative Schultz.
No, I have not entertained that, but tell me what you know.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, are you aware of any discussions of that taking place?
No rumors are coming to me, so your spies are in different places than
maybe
mine.
You know more than we do.
So is
not in the purview of our committee either. We should talk about the language and the legislation in front of us, sir.
Well, Madam Chair, because the language in front of us is obviously not thoroughly vetted, the reinsurance bill is. I don't think that's a good idea to attach this to other bills. This is my opinion. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now my head's going lots of other places, but I'm going to try to bring it back to where I was, and that's the defining of the material amount that would trigger the possible review. This is a possible review. This is not an indication of what can or cannot be done with those assets at the time. Is that correct?
Representative Schultz or Mr. Velzin, who would like to answer?
Sure, Madam Chair. So you are correct that it just triggers a review. So that doesn't mean they're going to deny that potential transfer.
Great.
Of that.
Thank you. And one other follow-up question. The reason that I bring that up is I'm looking at the examples that were handed out for HMOs that were undervalued at the time of conversion. And the first one was actually a modest increase of 3.5% after the conversion took place. The next one on the list is actually 56 times of what the conversion was charity that was considered at the time. And the last one on this is actually 125 times. So I think when we set something at $10 million or 10%, whichever is less, is actually sort of a good barometer to trigger the review. Again, there's not a determination of what the Attorney General would do at that time. But, you know, if the Minnesota taxpayers have close to $2 billion sitting in assets and reserves in our HMOs, I think it's fiduciarily responsible for us to actually make sure that that money is appropriated in a reasonable manner when it comes to the possibility of some of these HMOs triggering or turning over to a for-profit. And I know that none are in the process of doing that because we have a moratorium. At some point, that moratorium may be gone. And then I think that this would be actually a really good review process to protect those assets of the people of Minnesota. And that's all, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. And for everybody's planning purposes, I'm going to plan to bring this up for a vote, and then I would in about 5 minutes, and then I'd like to move on to Representative David's bill so his testifiers can speak, and we'll go till 4:15 in recess. Is that all right? Representative Davids.
Pass.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Chair. So I think
The health plan stated that there's no intention to sell or convert, but I'm wondering, you know, as a wise person once told me, everything's for sale if the price is high enough. And there's one entity in Minnesota who would have the resources, I know for sure, and this would be their bailiwick, would be United Health Group. So I wonder if there's anyone here from United Health Group who could come down. Well, I know there's somebody from United Health Group. I'm just wanted to come down, please. I don't do health care, so I don't know who it is.
I don't see anybody in the audience representing Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair. They're a nonprofit. They're not a nonprofit.
I know.
They could buy a nonprofit.
They could buy a nonprofit.
Let's go through the chair. Sorry, remember?
I'm sorry.
Remember your chair?
Madam Chair, could we do introductions again?
So they are not in the audience, Representative Lesh.
Yes, they are. There's someone here from United Health Group, Madam Chair. They're probably hiding behind the barrier.
Nobody's coming forward to speak. Can you proceed?
Okay. This is ridiculous, Madam Chair, because I know they're here, but I want to guarantee that all this stuff's like, oh, no one's going to sell, no one's going to convert, and I want to guarantee from United Health Group that they're not going to buy. That's what I want. So maybe they could get with me offline and promise me that way, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Additional discussion from members. Seeing none, Representative Schultz, your last word on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And because this has happened in so many other states, Minnesota has to be prepared. I don't know their intent, but if you use evidence from other states, they're converting. They're more for-profits, and we just have to be prepared with this legislation. So I urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 533, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No. No.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Thank you. You're on your way. Oh, I'm sorry. The bill is re-referred. You're on your way. Representative Davids, lightning round. Thank you very much. Representative Davids.
Well, like thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I'll move House File 994.
Representative Davids moves House File 994, and that re-referral would be to Ways and Means with a recommendation to Jobs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That is your motion. Are there amendments to your bill, sir?
Yes, sir, and good luck to me with that motion. I will now move the amendment, which is the H0994A1 amendment, and maybe if I could have Representative Haley describe that a little bit. It doesn't increase the cost. It's within the cost.
Representative Haley, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the author for allowing this friendly amendment. The amendment simply includes a provision that the commissioner could use some of the money allocated in the bill, $250,000, so a small amount of the total appropriation in this bill, to coordinate with nonprofits that work directly with businesses and entrepreneurs and investors to help grow this entrepreneurial ecosystem in greater Minnesota, and particularly work with minority-owned or women-owned businesses.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Further discussion of the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. Amendment is adopted to your bill as amended. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, to 994 as amended. Several years ago, the legislature passed a bill, I think it's, I don't know, $250,000, $300,000, to do a study on what the future looks like in southeastern Minnesota. And it looks very, very good. But we do have some challenges, whether it be housing, child care, and if, as you see in the bill on page 2, you'll see some of the different things that this bill would allow us to do. This is for southeastern Minnesota. The counties are listed on page 2. It's a little known fact that I was the original author of the DMC bill in the 2011 tax bill. We put the seed money in the Rochester sales tax money, so they paid for it themselves, to create DMC. Well, there's this thing in 2012 called an election, and I, all of a sudden, was no longer chair of the tax committee. So I went to the mothership at Mayo and said, you know what, you need a different author. And so Representative Kim Norton, who is now the mayor of the city of Rochester, was the author of the bill and took it through the process. And DMC has been an amazing success. And the surrounding towns around Rochester want to pitch in to help for the housing, the child care, in the different areas. Now, I have person that worked very, very hard on getting that study done, which was very, very important. So this bill is basically following, taking care of what's in this, what the results of the study were. And then I have Ryan Nolander from Journey to Growth out of Rochester. And again, I would like to make clear in the bill that this bill affects everyone in the counties listed on page 2 except the city of Rochester, which is kind of a novel approach. So it doesn't affect the city of Rochester, but it's the surrounding towns and townships and counties around the fine city of Rochester. So, Madam Chair, if I could send it over to Brenda Johnson, who had the idea to do the study in the first place, and then again, Ryan Nolander. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Ms. Johnson, if you want to just introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brenda Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for the Southeastern Minnesota League of Municipalities, a very long name that we will switch to SEMLM for this particular discussion. And yes, the SEMLM was the originator of the bill for the Southeastern Minnesota Regional Economic Impact Study that was funded through the state, through a grant appropriation, through deed. And we are very, very grateful again for the opportunity to have done this study. It was shepherded by SEMLM and CETA. See, I want to give credit to CETA as the pass-through agent, that's Community and Economic Development Associates. We are an organization in the SEMLM of 65 member communities, member cities, and across that 8-county area that you saw listed. We do not cover the 11-county area, but because we are a significant portion of that, the study became a true basis for the that we're describing today as well. SEMLM and CETA engaged HRNA to do the study, to conduct the study, and it was very thorough. I want you to understand that when we are talking about the bill today, it is based on a very, very solid study done by HRNA. The study evaluated the regional economic and demographic impacts throughout the 8-county area. In other words, it is very much a regional study. It covered all 8 counties. We had input from all of them. And the best part is that it uses an econometric forecasting tool called REMI, R-E-M-I. This is the same thing that DEED uses to do their forecasting throughout the state of Minnesota. So this is a quality study. I want to emphasize that again, because it is the basis for the bill. So what we found as we did the study is that there are particular areas of our regional economy that are not strong at all. They're very, very, they're in trouble. And the two key ones are housing and labor supply, which is impacted by child care. Those became the two hot buttons of the study, things that were identified as immediate and strong needs. The dollar value, the dollar impacts of those two things alone, the housing is a $4 billion impact that if we don't get it right, our region will experience a loss of economic output of over $4 billion. Now, that's just the 8-county area. Over 11 counties, that number would be even bigger. The child care issue is $1.14 billion. Again, that's just the 8-county area. 11 county, it would be bigger. I was really stunned, even after working with cities in this region for over 20 years, I was stunned to see the B's there, the billions. And when I think of billions, I think of those are numbers you folks work with. And eventually. So that's why we were very pleased to see this bill come forward, and pleased to see the authors are strong authors and they know our region. The SEMLM membership, again, 65 cities represented by our organization, they voted January 31 of this year to support this bill to address the issues identified in the study, and the cities are currently passing resolutions. In other words, having their membership organization support it wasn't enough for them. They're so enthused about this now. Individual cities are passing resolutions, writing letters of support, and I'm thrilled to see that they are not just putting this study on the shelf. Your commitment to Southeast Minnesota by allowing us to have the study done is being put to good use. Over the last few weeks, I have gotten calls and emails and conversations with cities saying, this is really a necessary thing. They cite that this is going to be a new and more flexible tool for them to be able to do what they know they need to do, but they can't do it without some more tools that work for them. And again, when you think about those 65 cities, about 60 of them are small towns. They don't have a lot of economic development tools. So they are basically, through me, asking for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Nolander.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Ryan Nolander with Journey to Growth. Journey to Growth was an initiative started 5 years ago to help diversify the southeastern Minnesota 11-county region. And we're here today to talk a little bit about this bill. Brenda stated a lot of the issues that we found with the study and how are we going to solve those issues. One of those tools is this bill. As Representative David's talked, he hit a few points, but the key thing is obviously it's designed around this study that was identified, the issues identified in the study. It is a $25 million evergreen revolving loan fund, $25 million ask, one-time money, not ongoing, no tails. For the 11 counties, does exclude Rochester. Eligible uses are agricultural, manufacturing, technology, healthcare, but the big ones that Brenda hit on, child care, residential development. Those are things that people are struggling with, and this study showed that with what they found, and this is a tool to help do that. So what are the things they can use it for? Equipment, facility improvements, employee housing, daycare construction or improvements. This fund would provide flexibility and assistance that currently isn't available with existing programs. And this help would then would help alleviate the issues that Brenda has mentioned. So the question may be, why Journey to Growth, why would they manage that? Our organization currently manages multiple funds and programs. One of those is a $5 million economic development fund for the city of Rochester. We also manage a $2 million venture capital fund, and our office houses the SBA 504 program, which currently services $130 million. So we have a history in dealing with funds and managing those funds. Today, I guess we're just here to support, get support from you guys in regards to this fund. We think it is a great tool that can be added to help fix some of these issues that we're currently facing in southern Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this would be to the bill author, Representative David. So this $25 million would be a revolving fund. And I read that there's a cap like 1% above a particular number. Is the interest charge then going to be used in the implementation of the program? And with a cap at 10 years, I'm assuming that this would be a perpetual fund. Just out of curiosity, what if in the next 20 years the fund grows from $25 million to $30 million? What would happen at that point?
Representative Davis.
I could defer to the witness, please.
Mr. Nolan.
Madam Chair, Representative. Great question and a great problem. It is a revolving loan fund, so the idea is to revolve those dollars back out. That's why there's that cap of 10-year loans. The idea in a perfect world, we would love to see this thing grow to 25 to 30 and continue to help our region with those funds. That's the idea behind it.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Davids. It says in here that the city projects within the city of Rochester are not eligible. And I have a question. Are there any parts of the Run DMC project that actually extend outside of the city of Rochester?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dean, Chairman Dean, they're all within the city.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a courtesy to my colleague, I look forward to seeing it in the Jobs Committee where it should have been sent the first time. I don't know why it came here. I certainly have a number of questions, but I think it'd be better suited to be asked in the Jobs Committee under the economic development stuff.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Chair Mahoney. that's where we'll go, hopefully.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Davis, street fire bill. I have a couple of questions. So first,
your
last line on the bill itself says the loan.
Representative Carlson, could you speak into the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that we can pick it up on the tape. Thank you, sir.
Yes, I get yelled at home for being such a loud talker. So that's Chair Davis. Line 3.32. The loan administrator may use up to $500,000 for program income annually generated from the interest and fees to offset administrative costs. Can you speak to the $500,000 for admin costs for this program?
I'm going to turn that over to Mr. Nolander also.
Mr. Nolander.
Madam Chair, Representative. That number, if you look at it, is based on fees and administrative cost and interest that's been collected. We're not exactly sure how much it's going to cost to administer, but when you look at staffing and if you've got to have a staff to manage a multi-million-dollar fund like this, we're looking eventually down the road that this might have to have a staff person or two dedicated to that. Again, that's all based on returns, though, on fees and getting the money out. It's not upfront money where we're saying we'll take $500,000 off the top. So,
understood. But
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Understood. That's clear in the statement there. But, again, $500,000 that's generated through these loans for administrative costs. You mentioned a hiring of one FTE. Can you speak in more detail to how you see those funds being used?
Mr. Nolander.
Representative. Those funds, you know, again, we don't know the exact dollars what it's going to cost to administer. And so it's going to be coming back to is that fund going to require a staff bigger than one person? Is it going to require two people? Is it going to require its own space? Is there going to be rent in there? Again, if you know it in there, it does say up to. So it's not saying it's taking $500,000. It is up to, depending on the budget that is determined with those funds that come back in.
Representative Davis.
Hey, Madam Chair, as this moves forward, as I hope it does, I would like to refine that a little better, too. I think Representative Carlson brings up a good point, and I think we need a little more detail on that.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Davis, with your willingness to work on that. One additional question. Usually with programs like this, revolving loan programs in particular, performance measures, number of jobs created, return on investment. I see you've got allowing for public infrastructure. You got a long list of things that this qualifies for. Can you speak to what the public good is going to be in terms of what we can expect in terms of the investment of these hard-earned taxpayer dollars?
Representative Davis or?
I defer.
Mr. Nolander.
Madam Chair, Representative. Those dollars, you know, when you look at the metrics of it, I think that's why we're here today. As I mentioned earlier, that there are programs out there currently in the state, but they're not as flexible. There are requirements that if you get these dollars, you have to create X number of jobs. When you come to some of these programs, when it's around housing, you're not creating jobs. You are creating construction jobs, but you're not creating that with a housing unit. So we're looking for something that's more flexible. Those metrics are things that we can work on and be defined, but at this time we wanted something that was a little more flexible for the usage of these things that we currently can't do with things like the Minnesota Investment Fund and other programs like that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional question? Oh, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like that could, Chair Davis, it seems like, and to your testifiers, it seems like that could be spelled out. Again, I understand asking for flexibility, but on a per-project basis, I mean, I guess the question is, how do you know if you're successful? How do you define success with this?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Carlson, excellent question, and I think we've got a little more work to do on that. I do believe that we need to be able to answer that question with in the bill on this is when we know we've arrived. This is how we measure success. And so you will see some work done on that.
Thank you, Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair Davis. Additional commentary from the members? Seeing none. Representative Davis, last word.
Yes, thank you, members. I think I'm actually very excited about this bill to get this moving forward. This can actually be a model. And some people said, well, why not my part of the state? And I say, hey, I agree. Why not your part of the state? Let's commission a study, a very thorough study. This study really came through with some very, very good information. And so to that question, let's move forward on that. But for today, we're looking at the eight counties in southeastern Minnesota, and members, I appreciate your support to get this to Ways and Means and then to Chair Mahoney's committee.
Thank you, Representative Davids. With that, Representative Davids renews his motion that House File 551 be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation to the Jobs Committee.
As amended.
Oh, let me do that again. We're going to re-refer House File 51 as amended. Oh, I'm sorry, 994. Sorry. We're going to re-refer House File 994 to Ways and Means as amended with a recommendation to the Jobs Committee. All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and you are on your way to Ways and Means, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And members, we need to do a couple of orders of business quickly to get you off to your next stop. We need a motion to approve the minutes, if somebody's had a chance to take a look at those. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We will be in recess to the call of the chair until approximately 6:30 and take up the rest of our agenda
here.
Thank you for that clarification. We are in recess. Well, no. Good evening. Welcome back. We are reconvening the House Commerce Committee, and we will be taking up House File 3. I see Representative Liebling is here and ready to present her bill.
Let's find out.
We'll let you get settled in. It's a lot of coffee at the table. I hope we're not here that long. Okay. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Chair Liebling. And if you need a moment to get settled, you may. That's fine.
I am ready to go, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you, members, for sticking around to hear this important bill. Members, House File 3.
Representative Liebling, how about if I move it in front of us?
That would be a great idea.
And do you have an amendment as well?
I do not have an amendment at this time, Madam Chair.
What's your name?
Different one. Okay. So I move that House File 3 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Now your bill is properly in front of us, and we don't
all
see
right.
an amendment.
Thank you.
You may proceed, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the bill before you is largely the governor's One Care plan. And since this is the administration's plan, and I certainly am no expert on the parts of the plan that are in front of this committee, which is the platinum product that is intended to be on the market in 2023, and then perhaps some other products if there is market failure. And I believe those are the sections that are in front of this committee. So I'm going to let my testifier do a thorough presentation of the bill, and she will be able to answer questions that the committee may have. So with that, I would turn it over to Marie Zimmerman from the Department of Human Services.
All right. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I would just ask our stellar researcher, Ms. Pompu, just to confirm what parts of the bill are we will be looking at tonight.
Chair Halverson and members, on page 10, there is an outline of a program by the Department of Human Services to have them run the prescription drug program for Minnesota Care. I know this has come up before the committee regarding manufacturing of prescription drugs and the specific program. And then on to page 13, we have definitions for the One Care buy-in. Also on page 13, we have the creation of the One Care buy-in program and how that's going to operate. And then we go on to page 17, and they discuss the products, the platinum, silver, gold, qualified plan rules. And that on page 18, the Department of Human Services will be operating the One Care Buy-In drug program. And below that, we have a study by the Commissioner of Commerce with the Commissioner of Health on the design and implementation of a state-based risk adjustment program.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Tomfu. Welcome to the committee. Did you have another comment?
Madam Chair, if I may, I think we have maybe a little dispute about what the jurisdiction may be, because there are two benefit programs that were just discussed briefly, and it would be my contention that those are completely within the Department of Human Services. They don't change anything with drug manufacturers. This is all, and we're talking at this time only about public programs. But, I mean, this is, of course, up to the chair, but that was our understanding, and that this is completely within the wheelhouse of the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Liebling. If you would like to proceed, you can introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Liebling. My name is Marie Zimmerman. I am the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. As Representative Liebling mentioned, we're here to talk about the One Care package. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor have proposed the One Care package as part of a larger comprehensive package to address access to comprehensive coverage, and that folks should be able to see providers in their own community and address the cost of prescription drugs. So the One Care package includes three parts. A couple of those were just discussed a few minutes ago here. One is reducing the price of prescription drugs through leveraging the state's current purchasing power and authority that we have of how we manage our current Medicaid fee-for-service benefit today. Increasing access to dental care by both having a uniform administrator and benefit, and then creating a comprehensive buy-in health coverage option, which is what we're here to talk about today. So I'm not going into depth on those first two things. If folks want to ask questions about how we administer Medicaid pharmacy fee-for-service today, and that's what we plan to extend to our Minnesota Care program, we can certainly do that and answer questions about that. So the One Care buy-in is intended to address a market failure and gaps by leveraging what the state has already done in terms of purchasing for Medicaid and Minnesota Care and leveraging its purchasing power. In 2023, the buy-in would offer a comprehensive platinum product statewide. And so that would encompass a couple of different things. Currently, there are no platinum plans offered in today's individual market. And I don't think there have been for a couple of years, but certainly my friends at Commerce and other agencies can give you the exact timeline on that. It's a 90% actuarial value plan, which means the premium would cover 90% of the cost of the care, and the consumer share would be 10%, so really intended to address those high out-of-pocket costs and high deductible plans. So it is meant for people who need to use healthcare or want to buy a product where there is less out-of-pocket expense and cost sharing. There's also a broader provider network and benefit set because we are leveraging and aligning what we do now for Minnesota Care, which includes dental, vision, and an expanded set of behavioral health services. We are also leveraging, as I mentioned, the state's purchasing power in lowering the cost of prescription drugs, whereby DHS, we do not use a PBM, and DHS is not a PBM. We pay claims directly, and we negotiate our own drug prices and rebates directly as well. Then in 2024, DHS would also ensure that consumers have more choice and affordability if there are additional market failures, as Representative Liebling mentioned, by offering a silver and a gold level buy-in product in any region of the state where the individual market fails to provide options. These market failures would be determined by the Minnesota Department of Health and would include regions of the state where there are no options available or the options that are available do not have a sufficient network. So that's essentially a broad overview. The staff went through the sections of the bill. So the ones that we're talking about here are sections 10 and 11 that establish the definitions used throughout the One Care statute. Establishment of the Section 12 is establishment of the One Care buy-in. Section 13 talks about the One Care buy-in products and the effective date of being effective January 1, 2023. Section 14 establishes the prescription drug benefit in One Care and mirrors what we did in Minnesota Care in that same bill and follows our same transparent process that we use today for the Medicaid program. And then Section 15 establishes the risk adjustment study.
Thank you, Ms. Zimmerman. We have a number of folks from the public who have signed up to testify on the bill, and if it's all right with you, we can take our public testimony and then have move to member discussion. Thank you very much. First person on the list, Bentley Graves. And that will be followed by Diane Hansen, just so everybody is, we got people on deck. And we are going to try to limit our testimony to 2 minutes. You can watch Amy for your time, clues. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Graves. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this evening, and I will keep it brief. As you heard Ms. Zimmerman speak about the One Care buy-in proposal, and as I'm sure you've heard of, Governor Walz provided his perspective on the need for this as well. You know, this obviously all centers on the cost of health care, and that reflects a concern that members of ours have had, employers purchasing health care for their employees for a long time. But it's that concern about health care costs that brings forth our concerns about this particular proposal. Already, those with commercial insurance pay more for the services they receive than those in public programs. And our concern is that a proposal like this that is rooted in bringing more people on our product that pays providers at those lower public program rates will have the consequence of raising costs for those with commercial insurance. And that's something that we believe will continue to put pressure on costs for employers and the benefits of that to their employees. And over the long term, you know, may very well bring significantly more instability to the commercial insurance market as well. So I know that you have other testifiers. I know there's much more to get to tonight, but I did want to come down and share those concerns, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. But thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Graves. Diane Hansen, followed by Richard Lett. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Diane Hansen. I'm a homemaker and a volunteer with AARP Minnesota and a constituent of Representative Liebling's. I'm here to testify in support of HF3, the One Care buy-in option. I want to thank Representative Liebling and Governor Walz for their leadership on this issue. My husband Brad and I are in our early 60s. Health insurance has been a constant worry for us since Brad retired. As a breast cancer survivor, the attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act were nothing short of terrifying. In 2018, even with reinsurance, the cheapest plan available to Brad and myself was a high deductible plan which cost $27,000 a year in premiums with a $6,000 per person deductible. That would have been paying nearly half of our retirement income for health care alone. Since that was not sustainable, we reduced our income in order to become eligible for the federal tax credits. It's a tricky situation. If we make just $1 over the limit, we are right back to those high costs. We're thankful for the efforts of the Minnesota legislature, which have been reducing premiums. But without the federal tax credits, our premiums this year would still be $25,000 a year, with a now nearly $7,000 per person deductible. An additional problem is our narrow provider network. When Brad broke his ankle in Wisconsin, we had to come back to Rochester for a surgery because otherwise it would have been out-of-network care with no out-of-pocket maximum. The same would have been true if he'd broken his ankle here in the Twin Cities. Unfortunately, we do not have the bargaining power to bring our costs down or to expand our provider network. That's why we're excited to hear about the One Care buy-in option. We think it could really help older folks like us who have the highest premiums by giving us access to a broad network of providers at more reasonable prices. This is especially true for farmers and small business owners who cannot opt to earn less to qualify for a tax credit. Brad and I urge you to support HF3, the One Care buy-in option. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. And Richard Lett, followed by Catherine Kmit.
Good
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. Good evening. So my name is Richard Letton. I'm an independent insurance agent living in Minneapolis, and I hope that accounts for the accent. I have significant experience of the British and the U.S. systems. I'm serving individual and small employer groups throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm here today representing the Agents Coalition, which includes the four professional associations in Minnesota, including the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Professional Insurance Agents, and the Independent Insurance Agents. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 licensed insurance agents in Minnesota and their employees. As such, we work closely with both group and individual market consumers on a daily basis. We stand opposed to the One Care proposal. The bill creates an uneven playing field where a government insurance company that is created by the same state government that is supposed to be the referee and regulator in the marketplace. First, it exempts its own products from the premium withhold that all other insurance products sold on Minsure must pay. Instead, it creates an undefined in-lieu reimbursement to Minsure. It is not clear from the bill language whether the in-lieu payments to Minsure is included in the premium or will be subsidized by the taxpayers. Second, the bill deems One Care to automatically meet HMO regulations under Chapter 62D, accident and health insurance regulations under 62A, market rules under 62K, and Minsure rules. Thank you. So insurance carriers must comply with all of these consumer protections, but One Care does not. The reimbursement rates are significantly low, which would threaten carriers and providers throughout the communities in Minnesota. We also think that the definition of affordable and comprehensive is undefined, meaning that it could be just at the choice of the commissioner to make that designation. Finally, we believe the bill will be sold as a solution to problems that previously existed in the individual market, but the bill has been greatly expanded to include the small group. So just finally, one sentence. In short time, we believe the Minnesotans will be left with no other choice than a government-run program. If this is your intention, we believe Minnesotans have the right to know up front. We oppose the One Care. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Catherine Kmit, followed by Bruce Miller. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee. You can say your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3. We appreciate the recognition that something must be done to stabilize the individual market to make coverage more affordable and accessible to Minnesotans who buy coverage on their own. I gave more detailed testimony in the House HHS Policy Committee, so I'll focus my remarks on a few key concerns. The Council strongly opposes the dental and prescription drug carve-outs because it will be much more difficult to coordinate care for members. Lower premiums for One Care mean reduced revenues for Minsure, so the state may need to appropriate more funds for Minsure. The bill says all the premiums collected must pay for all of the cost of coverage as well as paying for IT systems, operational, and other administrative functions. The governor's proposal for One Care establishes a reserve of $112 million. Does that mean that DHS is taking financial risk? What happens to the program if the program has more losses than premiums? Would rates in year two have to be raised to make up for losses in year one? The bill says the commissioner may modify the covered benefits and payment rates. Does that mean if the state is running low on funds that they can ratchet down the benefits and or the reimbursement rates to providers? Could they do that in the middle of a plan year? What would be the impact on access to care for patients? The bill requires providers to be reimbursed at Medicare rates. This means there will be more cost shifting by providers, thereby raising premiums for people covered in the commercial market. This bill will create a big disruption in the individual market and affect the stability of the small group market. It could mean the demise of the individual market. In summary, we are concerned that this bill creates an unlevel playing field between the state and the health plans. This seems to create a dynamic where the state is both regulator and competitor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Bruce Miller, followed by Sarah Greenfield.
Great.
You're not Bruce Miller. Well, but welcome to the committee anyway. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stu Laurie. I'm Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. Unfortunately, Bruce is tied up in another committee, but just wanted to speak briefly in support of H.R. 3. I'm here on behalf of our 14,000 members, family farmers across the state, to express our strong support of this legislation. It would provide meaningful options to family farmers and folks in rural areas. And though I'm new to Farmers Union, this is my third day. I've already talked to a number of our members about healthcare in particular. You know, we have a grassroots process, and we've defined this as a top priority. And, you know, even just this morning, talked to a member whose healthcare costs were such that he was almost forced out of his 100-cow dairy operation. So this is dire, and folks want to see action, and our members have defined this as a clear path forward. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thanks so much, Representative Leland. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Laurie, and welcome to the Capitol. Let's see. Sarah Greenfield, followed by Rick Varco. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I'm representing Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots organization representing 55,000 Minnesotans in every county of the state and 22 organizational members. We strongly support House File 3. As Minnesotans, we're united by the aspirations we share. We believe that every person has inherent worth and dignity and that there's enough for all. When our families have the health care they need, it changes everything. Good health care means we can live the American dream and sleep at night. Take Action Minnesota works on multiple issues at the Capitol, but health care is our top priority because it affects the majority of our members. Minnesotans like Sue Ellen, who went bankrupt because she couldn't afford health insurance, and Jana, a small business owner whose life changed the day she enrolled in Minnesota Care. But too many Minnesotans fear getting sick. The private health insurance market isn't working. According to a new report from the Healthcare Value Hub, about half of Minnesotans either can't afford health insurance, have health insurance, but it's too expensive to use, or are forced to make impossible economic choices trying to pay for their health insurance and medical bills. This is wrong. Our government is responsible for making healthcare work. It's no accident that there are no platinum plans offered. It's the kind of market failure that reveals exactly what's wrong with a market approach to healthcare. Insurance companies don't want to sell health plans that attract the kind of people who need a lot of healthcare. We need our government to rein in healthcare costs and a public option that truly covers people. OneCare will be that plan, and as was described by the earlier testifier, families should be able to afford to use the health insurance they have. Parents should be able to take their children to the doctor without fear of going bankrupt. No one should have to choose between filling a prescription and paying rent. We need health insurance that makes us healthier and puts people first, and we urge you to vote yes.
Thank you for your testimony. Rick Varco. And Rick is the last person to have signed up, so welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed.
Chair Halverson, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco, political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, testifying in support of House File 3. At the time the ACA and MinSure passed, we strongly supported a public option to make sure everyone had an affordable choice, but we were told that private industry could do the job. Clearly, they have failed. I am sure that all of you have heard time after time that premiums are too high and that even when premiums are affordable, high copays and high deductibles strip insurance of almost any value. For example, when the son of our member, James Holt Jr., tried to find a plan, the best he could find would cost him $450 a month with a whopping $7,600 deductible. Since his insulin and supplies cost almost $1,300 a month, he decided to go without insurance until he could find a job with insurance. Within a month, he had died rationing his insulin. House File 3, specifically the OneCare Platinum level option and the new prescription drug provisions, would give people like Alec an affordable option with lower levels of cost sharing. In addition, low cost sharing plans are extremely important for our members who want to retire before age 65. They could afford to retire, but only if there was an affordable insurance option. For them, the OneCare Platinum level product with its reasonable copays and deductibles would be perfect. OneCare expands on the success of our public programs by giving more Minnesotans a high-quality option. These public programs work well because they level the playing field between consumers and insurance companies. Even with strong regulations and heavy subsidies, individual consumers still don't have enough power to force insurance companies to offer quality products. OneCare, through the Platinum option and the further contingent gold-silver options, aggregates their power with the power of Medicaid and MinnesotaCare to get them a better deal. In fact, the main argument against the OneCare option seems to be that it will work too well, that everyone will choose it, and private insurance won't be able to compete. But if it, at the end of the day, people get better health care, why would we let that stop us?
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we can move to member discussion. Representative Swazinski.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the committee for taking the time tonight to come together. It's awesome spending an evening again with you. So kind of a question along the kind of the PBMs area. We talked a little bit. We've had a couple other PBM bills move through this committee, and it sounds like the state will kind of potentially kind of come, you know, start negotiating with manufacturers. And one of the issues with PBMs was that the consumers never see rebates. So if there's rebates issued by the drug producers, would the state receive the rebates, or would the individual consumers receive the rebates?
Representative Lee Bling, or if you want the department to come talk.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And we probably do need DHS to come down. But first of all, DHS already does manage quite a bit of drug benefit for the state. So in the Medicaid program, they don't use PBMs, and they have there is a federal drug discount program. So the state already gets discounts under this federal program. And, how that's passed through, I'm not exactly sure. But the problem, part of the problem that we have is we have right now PBMs within our, well, let me back up just a bit. If I don't know how much people understand about the way we do our public programs right now, but about 75% of it is contracted out to HMOs, and we pay them a capitated rate, and then they manage the, they pay the providers and all that. They all hire a PBM. And so within the public programs, the HMOs have another layer of administration. They all have a PBM, and that PBM sits between us, the state, paying the bills, paying the capitated rate, and our patient who's on a public program. So at least I would suspect, although we don't know, that a lot of money walks out the door there because the PBMs are not doing it for free. And I know we've all heard a lot about PBMs, and so we think that by pulling out that benefit and doing it separately, we can save lots and lots of money. And now maybe my testifier here can explain more how that gets filtered through to the patient or to the state, perhaps in this case, because we're talking about state programs which are paid for by taxpayers.
Well, welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Hope with DHS, Department of Human Services. The rebates within the public program are easy to explain, but at the same time difficult in that there's a federal law that prevents us from talking about specific rebates. It's almost a gag clause on the department. But what we can tell you is that, when we invoice for the rebates, those come directly to DHS. We share them with the federal government based on the split that's required in the federal law. It's based on the funding with CMS. And then the remainder of the state share is used to offset the cost of the services. So it's directly offsetting what we spend to administer the program. Within the MinnesotaCare and OneCare program, those rebates would be used to pay down the premiums, to offset the premium costs.
So,
Representative Swazinski.
So, Madam Chair, so essentially what you're saying is, so the federal money that comes in, whatever percent of the cost is, they're going to take their cut of a reimbursement from the drug company, and then the state would get their portion. Am I correct?
Mr. Hogue or Hope?
Hope, H-O-P.
Hope, Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representatives, within the Medicaid program, yes, CMS gets the share that's prescribed in the federal law, and then the state share is used to offset the cost of the service.
Okay. So
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the rebate is used to supplement the state side, but so when the reimbursement is less than the cost of care to an actual provider in the hospital, they don't see any of that reimbursement. So as they're, because the reimbursement is less than the cost of care, they're shifting those costs on other insurance buyers, so people in the individual market, they don't see, the hospitals or providers don't see any of that economic value. It's only the state as far as kind of reimbursing their own costs of what's going out the door.
Mr. Ho?
Madam Chair, Representative, there is actually no connection between hospital and drug rebates. Actually, in federal law, they exclude hospital claims from drug rebates.
Sure.
Representative Swazinski.
I understand. I'm just saying a dollar is a dollar, and a dollar comes into the program. Those dollars aren't used to buy down or raise up the reimbursements to the hospital, but they're used to decrease the cost to the state government.
Representative,
to the administrator of the Medicaid program, the state of Minnesota.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, this is kind
it's
of
a revenue source, yeah.
Right, and Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, this is somewhat, I don't know if you're here at the very beginning, but I was kind of saying that these benefit plans, we kind of don't even think they're within the jurisdiction of the committee because
sure.
This is about how the public programs are run. Mm-hmm. Now, at some point, there is a connection because the intention is to use this with the OneCare plan as the source of the pharmaceuticals, but this is all within Health and Human Services, and so to the extent that they save money
sure.
with doing this the way they do it without a PBM, that saved money ends up in the surplus that you see that you want to spend on tax cuts or something else. So this is saving the taxpayer money that falls to the bottom line. Medicaid, or medical assistance as we call it, is a forecasted program, and that means that when we save money on that program, whether it's from saving on drug costs or having fewer people enroll or cutting costs sure. of health care, it falls to the bottom line of the state. So that's where you see the savings.
Sure. And Representative Swazinski, it might be helpful to take a peek at the bill lines 11.11 through 11.18 because there's actual language regarding how the state is supposed to negotiate for lower drug prices
sure.
and report to the legislature what savings they get. And that is new in terms of, I think, the way that we've done business in the past. So.
But I think my point is that either way, whether it's you're going through a PBM or you're going through the state, the consumer himself that's actually purchasing insurance is not necessarily receiving the rebate from the manufacturers. And then just kind of one other question. So it looks like, just from a rate percentage of reimbursement, will hospitals also with the Platinum plan, if there's losses, be able to from the reimbursement rate, be able to pass that on to other insured or other patients within the system from the cost perspective?
Mr. Hope or Representative Liebling?
Well, Madam Chair, that might be more of a question for Marie Zimmerman. Mr. Hope is more on the pharmaceutical piece of this, but I think the intention is to cover the costs. And there's a lot of debate about this idea of cost shifting even right now. I mean, the reality is that we don't actually have a very good handle on what the real costs are of care. We know what the prices are often. We don't know what the real cost is, but I think that the intention by paying Medicare rates, which is more than we do now under our public programs, that our providers would be getting better reimbursement. Very important, though, is to understand that right now a huge source of losses to hospitals is uncompensated care that they have to give because people can't afford their deductible.
Sure.
So if you show up at the hospital and you can't afford your deductible, they have to give you the care and they have to eat that cost, right? Because you can't get blood from turnips, and if people can't pay, they can't pay. What having a Platinum plan would do is the out-of-pockets would be much lower, and so it would actually reimburse better for hospitals and other providers who would not have to eat that care, that deductible that people can't pay.
Ms. Zimmerman, welcome back. If you want to answer the question, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marie Zimmerman, DHS. I'm not sure that I could answer the question about between providers because I can't speak directly to provider, you know, practices and then their revenue and all that. Maybe just coming back really quick to clarify on the point of pharmacy. So to Representative Liebling's point, for the Medicaid program, there's a federal, you know, Medicaid drug rebate program. Yeah. And Medicaid has to cover any drug for any manufacturer that participates in that drug rebate program. It goes to directly offset the cost of the Medicaid program. So that's Medicaid. That's not even MinnesotaCare. MinnesotaCare operates and follows the rules a little bit more closely like QHP than it does for Medicaid because that's how it's funded. It's funded through advanced premium tax credit. For those programs, we would have a supplemental rebate, but the supplemental rebate is not anywhere near the magnitude of the federal rebate program for Medicaid. It's a much larger program. So the savings sort of comes from a couple of different places. One, it's not so much on the rebate, it's on the pricing and the fact that we have a preferred drug list and the pricing that we get on that preferred drug list. So the rebate is important, but on the non-Medicaid side, it's more on the pricing and less on the rebate. In terms of the savings that we're getting from the proposal, that savings comes from two places, which is mostly in the area of public programs. It is, for the last 3 years, we have historical trends of how DHS has managed our pharmacy benefit under fee-for-service, which is how we're proposing to manage the entire benefit across all three programs, Medicaid, MinnesotaCare, and the OneCare buy-in, okay? We have seen trend difference where we our trends that we've had in pharmacy have been anywhere to slightly negative to just a half a percent, where our health plans who currently manage, as Representative Liebling mentioned, through their PBMs, have seen anywhere from 4 to 6% trend increases. So the fact that we have that evidence, that's the difference and that's the savings. The other part of the savings is something that's more strictly Medicaid, which has to do with 340B providers and the state Medicaid agency being guaranteed the discount of 340B.
Thank you, Ms. Zimmerman. Well, Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of, we talked a little bit about some of the pharmacy component of it. You know, it's my understanding in the bill that there's a potential that the reimbursements for the dispensing fee to the pharmacist will be a bit lower than what's going on at the federal level. So from a federal program, mandate is like $11 or something like that. Looking at a reimbursement, maybe at like $1.50.
Welcome back, Mr. Hope.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. The language that is in the proposal would more closely mirror what is being paid by the commercial payers, so more like the commercial market, whereas the Medicaid program is subject to a federal rule called the Covered Outpatient Drug Rule that mandates that the dispensing fees be calculated in a very particular way. What is very different between this proposal and what the commercial market and the PBMs are doing is the payment is transparent. There would be no clawback, no diverting of prescriptions, no sort of gag clauses. All those other games that went away along with the PBMs operating that kind of blunts what the reimbursement is, none of those are there.
Sounds good. And just one final question. I appreciate that, Mr. Hope. More along the dental lines, just it's have you heard much? I mean, I've heard kind of issues in my neck of the woods when it comes to dental care and just access. Has there been much interest from dental providers with this program? Are they looking, you know, do you feel this is going to open up access to rural dental providers at all?
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to take this one. I know Ms. Zimmerman can chime in. But this has been a particular interest of mine, dental care, especially under a Medicaid program, where right now our dental care that our patients are able to get is pretty poor. And I know probably every one of us has had constituents say to us, I can't get an appointment with a dentist. I have this insurance. It's medical assistance I'm supposed to be covering, and I can't get an appointment. The dentists will say that they really dislike the way we do this because they, even though one patient, another patient both have medical assistance, they're covered by different insurers with different rules and require the dentist to handle different insurance when it's all the same program. And they hate that. So I haven't heard too much specifically about this proposal. I think the Dental Association has long wanted to get rid of that and have a single administration of the whole program for Medicaid, and I actually have a bill for that as well. That was there before this one. So that's coming from the dentists. They want that. Now, where there might be some disagreement and so on is how the rates are going to be set under this. And what I would say about that is that that's a work in progress from my point of view. I know that the administration's made a proposal of how to do that. I'm still considering, you know, as the chair of the HHS Finance Committee, how we should do the reimbursement. But it's got to be done in such a way that people actually get care, because there's very little sense in the state paying for a benefit that people actually don't get. And that is a lot of what I think has been happening. And dental care, we all know now how important that is to a person's health, and it's relatively inexpensive. And so for us to be paying for it and people not getting it is just not right, and that has to end.
Well, I think, yeah, thank you. And I think that's just the general concern, that obviously a bit maybe beyond the bounds of this committee. Appreciate your levity, Madam Chair. And I think that is it's an issue that we do here, is that they're just simply the especially in rural Minnesota, the doctors simply aren't there to provide, because they just aren't there to provide. And just one last question. In this bill, like, what aspects do you feel, you talked a little bit about the drug, but actually to drive the cost of health care down? So not the reimbursements, but the actual cost of health care within providers. Does anything...
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and if I could address that, and I'm sure Ms. Zimmerman will probably want to address that too, but I believe that the drug benefit, I mean, the cost of pharmaceuticals and the increases, we've had a lot of bills about that this session, and we're talking about that a lot. That's a huge cost driver. And what I like about this benefit that the administration is proposing is I really think that one of the best ways, probably the best way that we can control drug prices is using the state's bargaining power to get better deals. And that's what we already do in our Minnesota Care program and in our also in our medical, well, in medical systems as well, as Ms. Zimmerman was explaining. So I think that that is going to control prices. And, you know, eventually, after this thing gets off the ground, I hope that that pool and that buying power will be available to more Minnesotans to be able to use that to control the cost of drugs. Because right now, consumers don't have a chance. I mean, consumers are just at the mercy of the PBMs and whoever, the plans. Everybody keeps pointing the fingers at everybody else. But using our buying power, we are a big consumer, and if we get more people in that pool, I think we can bring down the cost of drugs, or at least control the increases.
Representative, I assume this is going to be the last question.
It totally is.
Excellent. Representative Swazinski.
Yes. And Mike, you touched on the...
I think it might be time for me to take over for a little while.
We can negotiate.
Representative Swazinski. Please,
Madam Chair, just you know, you spoke to the prescription drugs portion, but my question is more just on the driving the actual health care costs down. And I know we didn't really touch on that, but I think that's the point, is I don't know if this bill really addresses that, and I think that's a lot more work we need to do. But
it sounds, Representative Swazinski, like you are ready to join the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and we'll look forward to seeing your request.
Madam Chair, I do believe it's Lent, and I gave that up for Lent.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, can we refer this to the Jobs Committee? They might have fun with it as well.
Yes, please. We'll take care of it in about 20 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, in reviewing the bill, it looks like there's probably going to be 4 years of lead time to be able to make the proposal that's in House File 3 viable and available in Minnesota. And one of the things that I understand as well is that Minnesota would have to seek a second waiver, just like we did with the reinsurance plan from the ACA with the federal government. So we'd be seeking a 1332 waiver to be able to do this. And I have understood that the federal government is maybe not as generous with waivers and or a waiver for public programs. Do we have a plan or I guess, probably for lack of a better term, plan of attack of how we would want to approach the federal government with that, or a parallel plan in case that doesn't come to fruition in that four-year period of time?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you for that softball question, Representative O'Driscoll and Madam Chair. I, I think we should, the first approach I would like to make is to have a different administration in a couple of years. That would be a really good change. You know, we had an administration come in and try to repeal the Affordable Care Act, try to dump millions of people off their health care, has done things to undermine, I think, you know, even the Affordable Care Act, to try to undermine the functioning of the Affordable Care Act, and so on and so on, and everybody from insurance companies and everybody else has had to be constantly reacting to that and worrying about what's going to come next and are we going to be able to continue. And millions of Americans and Minnesotans have been very worried about whether they're going to have care, and we had testimony from Ms. Hansen about that very thing. So that is part of it. I have to say I am disappointed that this is a plan that doesn't go in for 4 years. I mean, although I'm carrying the bill, obviously I didn't write this plan. This is the administration's plan. I don't think it goes far enough in that respect. I think it's a plan that really tries to preserve the individual market. That is not a goal that I share, frankly, and I think everyone knows that. I think that we ought to be going to a universal care, a different model, because I think that the individual market has already failed, and we're just trying to keep it going and patch it together with duct tape. You know, that's how I view this. But, you know, given that, I think, you know, it certainly offers consumers the hope of being able to get a plan at a reasonable price that actually provides health care for them, which is something that way too often right now they're paying tons of money and not able to get care. And that is really a crying shame, something that somebody needs to try to address.
Representative O'Driscoll, follow up.
Yes, so as Representative Liebling said, for the softball question, what I heard was, let's hope for a different administration in a few years was probably our parallel plan to try to get the 1332 waiver. I want to just pursue another set of questions, of things that have come to me in my time at the legislature, from providers who talk about Medicare reimbursement, talk about Minnesota care reimbursement, private insurance reimbursement, and to a lesser degree, private pay kinds of activities that the individual seeking health care would pay. I've been told that the Minnesota care doesn't really even reimburse very effectively the actual hard costs that the clinics and doctors and hospitals provide. If we are to expand the program and continue with a reimbursement schedule that's less than what the hard costs are, that only creates a more pressure, hardship, or weight, or a heavy on the program. My understanding is that by trying to take the Minnesota care, Medicare maybe reimburses a little bit better, but not that much better. But we're really relying in solvency in these clinics and hospitals on kind of a three-prong approach, and one of those is the private insurance market. So what kind of stability are we going to have in the system if private insurance goes away and we're on a less than hard cost reimbursement? And I realize it's kind of a stubbly question, but I think you get the gist of my question, Representative Liebling. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. Well, I'd love to debate that with you, but that's not the bill that's before us, so I don't know if we want to take the committee's time to have a debate about universal health care. I think I would win that debate, but nevertheless, I don't think that's the bill that's before us. So if you have a question that's to the bill, I would be glad to address that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Okay, well, I just simply asked how Minnesota care would be different under the delivery in this plan than how Minnesota care is currently being delivered. And if we can maybe just confine the conversation to that portion as it relates to the bill and how this would be different than Minnesota care would be right now, because we're using a lot of the same principles for Minnesota care to implement the program that's being discussed in House File 3 this evening.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my understanding, and Ms. Zimmerman can correct me if I'm wrong, this is not a Minnesota care buy-in. This is not using the Minnesota care program. This is putting a new product on the market that will be a public product, but it will be a QHP. It'll be through Minsure, and people will buy it through Minsure, and it will be something that people will pay a premium for. Now, the governor has some other proposals to help people afford premiums, which kick in earlier. We're not discussing those tonight, but you know, this is because they're tax proposals, essentially, and proposals. So But this is not Minnesota Care. This is a buy-in product that's a separate QHP, just a publicly established one. And maybe Ms. Zimmerman would want to tell me if there's something I missed there or if you want to add something.
Nope, thank you. Representative Wojcicki, follow up.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my final thoughts for right now on the proposal would be, I'm concerned even if we were to get this passed off the House floor, the Senate agrees, the governor signs. I think it is worth asking the question: what do we do from March 13th, 2019, until 4 years from now when the plan gets into place? What are the things that we can do for the safeguards? Because I would suspect that we're going to have the same kinds of issues, questions, and problems that we've been hearing about. A common one is insulin rationing, people becoming sicker, and unfortunately, in some cases, death has occurred in those. How do we bridge that gap between where we are today, again, March 13, 2019, to 4 years from today till this plan gets put into place? And I think that's a fair question to at least get some kind of background or an idea from the bill author as to how we transition from where we are to where we want to be in her proposal, House File 3.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Wojcicki. Well, this is a more of a plan than just the piece that we've been talking about. First of all, there's a market stabilization piece that proposes a 20% discount on insurance premiums, kind of similar, not exactly the same as what Governor Dayton had done in 2017 before the insurance company subsidies came in instead. And then the next year, you have the beginning of a state-based tax credit that puts in an affordability standard and uses state dollars to help people pay for premiums when they're above the current 400% of the federal poverty level. You know, right now, under the Affordable Care Act, up to 400% of poverty, you're eligible for these advanced premium tax credits, APTC, we call them in jargon. And that helps people pay for their premiums, and there's an affordability standard, so it depends on your income and what the plans cost. But when you get to that 400% of poverty, there's a big cliff there, and if you're a dollar over that, and I think Ms. Hansen was talking about that, she's nodding her head, that's exactly what she meant. Then you're paying the whole freight yourself. So what the governor's proposal would do is extend those tax credits up to make it affordable basically for everybody. Now, that doesn't give us plans with better deductibles, though. I mean, that is still a problem. You know, this isn't solving every problem immediately. I wish it did. We do have a lot of bills going through this year dealing with the prescription drug problem, which is just an absolute crisis. So I'm hoping that we as a legislature can do something more immediate about that issue to try to stop people from dying for lack of insulin and stuff like that, and be able to allow people to buy essential medications without going broke. So maybe Ms. Zimmerman would want to add more to that if I missed anything. So, you know, I guess it's the problem here is, are we going to let the best be the enemy of the good? You know, this is an urgent problem for folks. I hear from some of my GOP friends here, I hear kind of two arguments. One is that the reimbursements are too low, and the other is that we want to control the cost of health care. And to some degree, those things are incompatible. You know, if we want to control costs, part of controlling costs is that we pay too much, or some people may be paying too much, put it that way, not necessarily the public programs. But, you know, I think some of this has to come down to figuring out what the actual cost of care is. And that is something that I think too often we really don't know what the cost of care is.
Thank you. Representative Wojcicki, and are you wrapping up? Or
yeah, this okay. will be the final.
Thank you, Representative Wojcicki.
I don't even know if it necessarily needs a response, but I will kind of, since Representative Davis isn't here this evening, he made a comment on the floor the other day that I think is worth repeating, that the insurance companies, you can agree or disagree, that the premiums may go up by 50%. But if you premiums go up by 50% and there's a 20% tax credit or tax break, it's still a 30% increase from where we are today. And I think that an important component component of this is going to be to extend the reinsurance program here in the state of Minnesota to continue to keep that 100,000 plus people who are purchasing products through the MinSure program with peace of mind for their families and small businesses as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, there's hours of questions that I have on this proposal. So just one brief one. You're saying that this will be an affordable option.
I mean, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I thought you were done. I was going to recognize her. Finish. You may finish.
Okay.
Can I apologies.
No problem. I mean, today people aren't buying platinum plans because they're too expensive. So you said this is going to be an affordable option. What will those premiums look like? I mean, you must have a ballpark number in mind, and we need to be looking at a ballpark number in order to know what this bill is going to do. So, can you answer that question?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I said at the outset, this isn't really my proposal. This isn't my preferred way of doing this. So I'm going to let Ms. Zimmerman answer that one.
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Marie Zimmerman, DHS. So part of this bill includes resources for us to do the modeling and also to submit the 1332 waiver. So currently we do not have estimates on the premiums for this program. Because it is so far out, there's changes that could happen to the market that would impact that, and we would have to reflect that in the modeling, and we would have to submit that as part of the application, of which would be a public process. People would be able to public comment on it. But here's a couple of things maybe that I can tell you about, I think, why we think we would be a little bit more efficient. One is the prescription drug piece, and we have that savings represented in the budget page as it relates to public programs, and we believe that that would extend to the buy-in product as well. We also have lower admin costs. So on that pharmacy that we operate now for in fee-for-service for 300,000 Medicaid enrollees, we have 5 FTEs that run that program, and we are not proposing to increase the number of FTEs for bringing all of that in-house for the rest of the Medicaid program or for Minnesota Care or for the buy-in. As it relates to our overall admin as well, we tend to run around, for example, when we contract with our health plans, around 9%. I think it is close to double that now for the individual market in terms of admin costs. We have also done a lot to do a lot of purchasing reform. So in terms of addressing the cost of healthcare and trying to lower the cost of healthcare, we have a program that we started in 2013 called the Integrated Health Partnership Program. It is a program that contracts directly with providers for meeting certain outcomes and reducing the health, sort of keeping an eye on the total cost of care, but also gives them payments for care coordination and care management. That program has saved about 200 and I want to say 70-ish million. I'm looking at my folks over here. I think it's around that number in savings since that program has begun.
Representative Haley, you said you had hours of questions. Representative Mahoney got a little nervous.
Yeah, I will not go there, Representative Mahoney, tonight, but I mean, just a couple of things. 9% admin is a high admin cost, and the savings to IHPs, to my knowledge, aren't reflected really back in the budget to the state of Minnesota. So I guess I take issue with those comments. None, I guess, of what you said, and I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, but none of those matters if premiums are too high. I mean, I just don't believe that this program is going to address the cost of health care and the cost of insurance. And when you look at districts like mine where 70% of the people are on public pay programs and 30% are private pay and the 30% are subsidizing the 70% that are in public pay, this is a further disaster for my district. And I fear reduced access to care. I fear hospital closures. I fear rationing of care. We all want to lower the cost of health care. That is what we all share. But I do not see anything in this proposal that is going to accomplish that.
Representative, where's the announcer? Further member discussion? Seeing none.
Going once, twice, three times?
I will renew my motion that House File 3 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and you're on your way to Government Operations, Representative Liebling. Thank you. We have one more bill. Before we take that up, I do want to ask folks a favor because we're asking staff to stay late all these days, and I would like to do my mom thing and ask you to think about tidying up, separating your green sheets from this, from your papers, and separating them into different piles so we can get staff home.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Can you can only imagine how I responded to my mother when she used to ask that of me, right?
I can only imagine, Representative Mahoney. Representative Liebling is bringing to us House File 551. So I will move House File 551 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation to go to HHS Finance. And Representative Liebling, I believe you have an author's amendment. Is that correct?
I do, Madam Chair.
Very good.
A1.
A1 or? I think it's an A3.
Oh. You may be right there.
Hang on 1 second. We're going to just double check. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's an A3. Okay. Folks in the audience, we're still running our committee, so we're going to try to figure out this amendment. I'm gonna have to make people tidy up. Okay, are we agreed at CA3?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
A3, thank you.
Want to be sure we get this correct. So I will move the A3 amendment to your bill, Representative Liebling. Is there discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Your amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I know the night is long here. And members, this is a bill. This is what I call my network adequacy bill. This bill goes back to what Representative Swedzinski was asking about, the fact that so many of our constituents who are on our public programs, in fact, do not get the care that we think that they are entitled to get. And often they are, you know, when they go on our public programs, they are entitled to certain package of benefits. And sometimes they don't get those benefits. Maybe there's no dentist. Maybe there's no mental health provider. Maybe they call the mental health provider, but the person has no appointments available. And it can be very difficult. So over the years, I've been very troubled by this, as I know that many of you have been, because I hear about this from other members all the time. And if I ask you for a show of hands, I bet there's not one member who has not heard this from your constituents. So it turns out that the adequacy of networks for the HMOs is regulated by the Department of Health, and the Department of Health gets many, many requests. The way we do our networks, the way we define adequacy of networks right now in our law is that you have to be able to, the plan has to be able to provide a healthcare provider within so many miles and so many minutes of the enrollee. But well, I was very surprised to find out that, in fact, if there's, say there's a dentist within 30 minutes of the enrollee, but that dentist will never give an appointment to a patient who's on medical assistance, that still counts as an adequate network. Because we don't require in our network rules that there be an appointment available, only that there be a provider available. And the Department of Health has been regulating this for some time, and I think has struggled to really do better for us. So I think I've handed out to you a map that shows there is an exemption process for plans that cannot meet the rules for having enough providers, even under our current rules. And there is an exception process for that. And you can see in what I've handed out here that in 2019 there were 4,985 waivers issued to health plans where they couldn't provide the adequate network even under our current rules. And in 2018, that was only slightly less. So I'm doing two things, two main things in this bill. One is changing the rules around what constitutes an adequate network. There are other states, I think California notably, that do this by how long a person should have to wait to get an appointment rather than, oh, you've got to have a provider within a certain number of miles, certain number of minutes. I want to say up front that this bill is still a work in progress. I have in the bill some proposed standards for that, and those are still open to you know, open to input from providers, because frankly, I don't know. I'm not an expert on how long a person should have to wait, say, to see an endocrinologist if they have diabetes, or how long should they have to wait to see a mental health provider. You know, what would be a reasonable amount of time to wait? So those certainly can be changed. The other thing that I have done here is change the process for complaints and for getting these waivers. One of the, in fact, GOP members in our committee, when we heard this bill in HHS Finance, asked a very good question. Actually, we weren't hearing the bill. We were having just an overview of how all of this works. And he asked a very good question. How much did they pay to apply for a waiver? And the answer was nothing. So one of the things that this bill does is start to put in place a fee for applying for a waiver, and that fee would go to support the more having more personnel in the Department in the Department of Health, which is the regulator here, to be able to beef up their regulation process. And one of the things I'd really like to see is kind of a secret shopper. So how are we going to know if there's never an appointment available? Well, somebody has to call up and say, I'm on Medicaid, can I get an appointment? So that's the attempt here. I mean, the bill, as I say, is still a work in progress. The amendment that I put on at the beginning, that you members allowed me to put on, comes out of some discussions that I had with Ms. Commit from the Council of Health Plans. It doesn't satisfy all of her concerns, but it is a bit of a compromise here. And that is saying that if she's concerned, and I think it's natural for her to be concerned about what if there just isn't a provider. In some counties, we know there just aren't enough providers of certain kinds. My overall response to that is that under our system where we're paying a capitated rate, it is the responsibility of the health plan to figure out how to get more providers, whether it's paying a higher rate or doing something to encourage there to be a new kind of clinic or whatever they have to do. It's kind of on them because we pay them this rate for a certain amount of care, and if they can't provide it, they are the ones who have that in their ability to fix. But this is a bit of a compromise because it says that the health plan can apply for a waiver and say there's no provider to meet a certain need, and then they would be able to, they may be able to get permission to use telemedicine to fill that particular need in that particular county under the waiver process. So that is a bit of a compromise. But this does not go on forever because these exceptions end, they have to be reapplied for, and the purpose of this is to again say if the state is going to pay you to provide this care, and we have, you've all probably heard the term black box, we pay these plans a certain amount of money and then we don't know who they pay, how much they pay, it's all a secret from us, so they've got to figure it out. We're paying them for the care and they've got to figure out how to deliver the care. Madam Chair, the final thing I want to mention just quickly is that there is a piece in the governor's budget to beef this up as well. The Department of Health is interested in making some change. So I think even though, you know, change can be hard, I don't think they are not opposing this in any respect. They may have things that they need to work on with me. They're giving me the thumbs up there, but they are also here, I think, to answer questions if you have some.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. We do have one person who has signed up to testify, and I have a member question. Would you like to take your question now or after the testimony? Okay. Mr. Lehman. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a handout if the page could distribute this. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, otherwise known as MATCHUP, and also the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. MATCHUP represents the state's three county-based purchasing, or CVP, plans, the 25 counties operating those plans, and the more than 86,000 people that they serve. Because of growing interest by county commissioners in county-based purchasing, 11 additional counties in southwestern Minnesota will be joining a CBP next year. County-based purchasing plans have been instrumental in creating greater local access to timely health care across rural Minnesota for more than 35 years. Indeed, a primary reason that county commissioners created the three CBP organizations was concern about their constituents getting the care they needed from the plans that used to serve their communities. CBPs are meeting that goal. A few moments ago, we heard Representatives Swizdinski and Chair Liebling talking about the problems of dental access and the problems that many of you have heard from your constituents about not being able to see a dentist or being denied an appointment because the person was on medical assistance. Well, according to data collected by the Department of Human Services, the highest rates of access for dental care in the state for medical assistance enrollees are CVP counties. Good news, Representative Swizdinski, because your district's counties are going to be joining one next year. With Representative, how's that? And so greater access is coming. CVPs provide higher rates of access to dental care than either the HMOs or the Department of Human Services through its fee-for-service dental program. We do not have concerns with Chair Liebling's bill as currently drafted. Our members are meeting these timelines that are set in the bill. If they were to be tightened, we may have some concerns. Going on to another issue that has already been raised as well. One of the biggest problems that patients have in getting the care they need is the severe shortage of certain types of providers. Representative Liebling mentioned endocrinologists, psychiatrists or another, dermatologists or another. There's a host of providers, particularly in rural Minnesota, that just aren't there. For example, every county in the state, except for Olmsted, has either a severe shortage or a critical shortage of child psychiatrists based on national standards. This shortage is worse in Minnesota, but a partial solution to address the problem of a shortage of providers is not being implemented. Current state policy is blocking the ability of physician assistants who are licensed to practice medicine and could provide primary as well as specialty care from practicing. For example, a physician assistant in Brainerd specializing in dermatology was forced to stop practicing there when the physician that signed her delegation agreement moved to Duluth. As a result, Brainerd went from having two clinicians licensed to practice medicine in the area of dermatology to having none. No timely access to care for folks living in the Brainerd area. Similarly, a physician assistant that wanted to practice psychiatry in central Minnesota had to wait 6 months last year before he was able to begin practicing because he couldn't find a physician willing to sign his delegation agreement. The legislature should be doing everything within its power to allow clinicians licensed to practice medicine by the Board of Medical Practice to be able to provide care to patients. Last year, physician assistants provided care in 10 million patient visits in Minnesota. Allowing them to practice within their current scope of practice without regulatory barriers would be an important step to assuring that patients needing care receive it on a timely basis. Again, Madam Chair and members, Chair Liebling is correct to be asking the question, do public program patients getting their care through a managed care organization actually get their care? That's a completely reasonable expectation and a conversation that county-based purchasing plans are not afraid to have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. And I think I was informed that there was somebody else who had signed up to testify. She wasn't on my list. Ms. Kmit, are you on the list or not? Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one. Member questions. Representative Swizdinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of a kind of going through the trend of the night, just let's say for a miracle HF3 becomes law, how would this bill interact with that if both of them happen to become in the law?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, this bill has to do with public programs right now, okay? The One Care package is not about public programs. Well, it's not really changing what we do right now with our public programs with regard to just coverage and contracting with the HMOs and all of that. So the two things, that obviously there's always a relationship in the health and human services world. There are a lot of odd relationships between all kinds of things, but it doesn't really, the two things are really separate here. So if the One Care package passes, you know, you've got the benefit plans, the dental and the prescription. It would pull the dental out of this altogether, so there wouldn't be any access standards. People wouldn't get their dental through the HMO. They would just be on medical assistance, and they'd get it through the one administered plan. So that would be different. But this would still apply to all the other care that they're getting under that capitated rate that we pay the HMOs.
Sure.
Representative Swedzinski.
So, I mean, if I kind of understand the way the bill would potentially work would be, so currently in state law we have bills that come through that says, hey, we want to increase the amount of doctors we have. We're going to have a bill to, you know, lower the cost of tuition or taxes or tax credits or whatever. Same with dentists. It will help pay for your care if you work in a rural area. So essentially you would shift that from a bill that a legislator would carry and shift that to the responsibility of the HMO, because the HMO would then be fined and say you need to put into the cost of the insurance plan or the cost of the government plan, and they would have to go out and provide and train and create a tax credit and do all those things. Is that essentially what this bill would do?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, no, it's a great question. You know, a provider who's, say, out in greater Minnesota is probably going to be serving not just public program patients, but other patients as well. So it isn't, that's only, so it's partly true. So if they're contracting with the state and saying, we're going to provide care to somebody in a rural county, for example, and there's nobody there to provide that care, what are we paying them for? So they're going to have to think about it when they sign that contract. And there are things they can do. One is, as Mr. Lehman was talking about, county-based purchasing. How do they get more dentists? How do they get their people served? Well, one is they probably pay higher rates. They do other kinds of things to facilitate those dentists seeing those public program patients. And, you know, the problem is that right now HMOs, health maintenance organizations, really they're managing money. They're really not managing care very much. They have a network and they're paying providers, and oftentimes the providers tell us, they come to us too. Our constituents come to us and say they're not getting the care, and providers come to us and say, I can't provide the care on what the HMOs are paying me. And we have no control over that. So this puts it on them. If there's really a problem, they'll have to come back and say, when they negotiate their contract with DHS, they'll have to say, we can't provide this care in this county, or something along those lines. So, you know, they do have a lot more control over this. For example, I know sometimes the plans have had mobile dental units. Sometimes they have, you know, funded a clinic. They do that sometimes to make sure that care is available in certain places. I don't know what they can do. They need to get creative, because they're the ones that are getting paid to do it, and it isn't happening. And if it can't happen, then we as legislators need to know that it can't happen and stop paying somebody who says they're making it happen.
Representative Swedzinski, it looks like Ms. Kmit from the plans has a response to your question as well, since you asked about the plans.
I finally said something that made her get up.
Welcome to the committee. You can reintroduce yourself and
thank you, Madam
proceed.
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I just took a look at the bill as in the first engrossment, and in fact, the bill was pretty heavily amended in the previous committee, and so it does apply not only to government programs, both PMAP as well as Minnesota Care, but it also applies to health plans for all of their commercial business. So it's more than just on government programs. It applies very broadly to the entire health plan process and all of their networks. So I just want to clarify that. I also just want to say thank you very much, Representative Liebling, for this amendment, and I'm looking forward to continuing working with you.
I'm good.
Okay.
Let people go home.
Representative Haley. Sorry, Mahoney.
Who goes first?
You, Mahoney. Representative Mahoney goes first.
Thank you.
And the lights are starting to hurt my eyes in here, so my apologies, Representative Mahoney.
Excuses. Thanks. Representative Liebling and my colleagues down the table here have been complaining about lack of physicians, lack of medical professionals. About 6 years ago, I was shocked in a committee room up on 400, late like this, and it was the second deadline. I was running the jobs committee, and I got a bill that came up that asked for $500,000 to train foreign-born, foreign-trained physicians. And, you know, being the pipe fitter that I am, I thought it was a bunch of hooey. And so I said I thought I'd be a smart committee chair and say, really, if there's any foreign-born, foreign-trained medical professional, stand up. About 40 people stood up. Yeah, that's the sound that a chairman makes when he puts his foot in his mouth. And anyhow, they got, I think Gunther and I figured out a way to come up with $500,000 or $1 million. And the last number I heard was they had 350 nursing assistants, nurse assistants, whatever they're called, and physicians. And I suspect there's a few dentists in there too. I know there's a bill heading to my way. Would you like to have it in your committee?
That was a question.
I don't believe that was to the bill, so no. I assume that will be returned. We will let Representative Liebling marinate on that a little bit. And move.
Chair, I would just say I'd be happy to talk with you offline about that.
Representative Haley.
My colleagues are giving me a stare. So I'll be very brief. Representative Liebling, I just respect your years of study and focus on this area, and I share your desire to lower healthcare costs and to make access better. I really do, and I wish we had a silver bullet to all these perplexing problems. But just one comment, the idea of a secret shopper for health plans, I have to say, the calls that I get into my office about MNsure, I'd love a secret shopper to MNsure. Even today, yet a woman who has been struggling for 2 years to get the plan that works for her and still can't get the right answer. So let's put a secret shopper there first. But that's a comment. But my question about network adequacy, a different way of looking at it, in rural areas, maybe sometimes we have to look at how broad can we define that? And the amount of specialists that the plans are required to have in a certain geographic area in some ways increases our healthcare costs and increases the cost of these plans. And maybe there's another way of doing this. If somebody is willing to travel to see a specialist, and for my region that might be 30 minutes, you know, not a huge burden in some cases, if that could lower their cost of a procedure or a visit, could they share in that savings? And I'm not asking you to solve that today, but that's another bill. But maybe we need to have different approaches to this idea of network adequacy that could help us reach the goal of lowering cost and giving people choice. And if you have a comment on that, I'm interested to hear.
Madam Chair and Representative Haley, in fact, to see specialists, I think it's 60 miles or 60 minutes. I mean, it's not the same for every kind of care right now. You know, when people go to buy, if we're talking about private health insurance, individual market, people go to buy a plan, supposedly they see what the network is and where the providers are. But still, if you don't have networks, I mean, I could sell you a really cheap insurance plan if there's no health care covered. If there's no providers in it, it'll be really cheap, you know, and you could buy lots of those. So I mean, network adequacy rules are there for a reason. You know, a person's buying a plan, and it's got to mean something. Having it has to mean something. It has to mean that you can actually use it and get health care. So, you know, there's, again, you know, this is one of those, there's always a trade-off. There's always a trade-off, right? Cost, access, you're never going to get the perfect solution. But, you know, I just, and, you know, the little compromise that I reached with Ms. Commit here is kind of reflects that, you know, maybe in some cases it makes sense to allow people, because there's no specialist there, to let the Department of Health give them a waiver that says you can use telemedicine for this one to meet your requirement for this limited time and place. You know, maybe we have to do some of that to actually get this stuff to happen. But I just know that, you know, if the plans hold themselves out as they're going to provide this care, and they have a contract to provide this care, and then they don't provide it, then I feel like we're not doing our due diligence for the people we represent, because it's a lot of money. And we better make sure we're at least getting what we're paying for.
Follow up, Representative Haley. Thank you. Further member discussion? Seeing none. With that, I will renew my motion on House File 551 as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation to HHS Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The motion.
Thank you very much.
The bill is on the way.
Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative, thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a warning, if you could, as we wrap up this evening, give us a little bit of a roadmap of what Friday might look like, and then next week for the committee's work schedule.
Friends, we are coming close to the end of the first deadline. Friday, we have bills posted. You can look and see what is posted. We will plan to convene at 9 a.m. on Friday, and take up bills until we are done. That will complete our work for the first deadline, and then we have a number of bills that we'll be taking up the following 2 weeks that have made deadline in the Senate. Is that all right, Representative O'Driscoll?
If you would like to go into a little more specificity, I think we can give you a couple more moments.
Specificity about what?
I know first deadline week is always kind of tough, and then we get fewer in the second deadline. I'm just wondering if you're planning on, if you've got an idea of what might have been referred and what may be coming back our way, and some of those kinds of things that are in the pipeline. Are we looking at closer to 25, 50, 75, 100 bills?
I don't have that list with me, okay. Representative O'Driscoll, so we can follow up later in the week if you want. Okay, very good. All right, with that, members, see you Friday at 9 a.m. We're adjourned. Thanks for